stop thinking about music and politics, I might be able to listen in silence to your concerns, rather than hearing everything as an accusation or an indictment against me. And I would tell you that sometimes I use sex to avoid.
This is the Quality News Network. The former chief of staff to Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, Kyle Sampson, who recently resigned, will testify Thursday before the Senate Judiciary Committee about the controversial firings of 8 U.S. prosecutors. However, the Associated Press reports another Justice Department official involved in the incident, Monica Goodling, will invoke the Fifth Amendment and refuse to answer the senator's questions. The White House continues to stand behind the Attorney General. Defense Department investigators who completed a year-long probe of the friendly fire death of former football star turned Army Ranger Pat Tillman found no criminal negligence. Tillman was shot to death in Afghanistan in 2004. However, the investigators found missteps and are recommending that 9 officers involved be held accountable. One of them is a 3-star general. Iran is under increased pressure to release the 15 British soldiers and Marines that were seized Friday in the Persian Gulf. Tehran insists they were in Iranian waters, while Britain insists they were in Iraqi waters. Today, Iran interrogated the British forces to determine whether they intentionally or unintentionally entered the Iranian territory. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon and Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice are both in the Middle East for peace talks. In Northern Ireland, a historic agreement has been reached between Protestant and Catholic political leaders to end 3 decades of sectarian conflict. 3 of the bodyguards of the Iraqi deputy prime minister, who was badly hurt in a suicide bomb attack last week, are implicated in that attack. He is listed in stable condition. 9 people were killed. The presidents of Russia and China today are urging Iran to fulfill the UN Security Council's demands to halt its uranium enrichment program. In Pakistan, more than 1,000 people have been arrested for taking part in opposition rallies against President Pervez Musharraf. He suspended the country's chief justice last month after accusing him of misusing his powers. The former Reagan administration budget director, David Stockman, was charged today with securities fraud. He had been a chief executive with an auto parts company, which declared bankruptcy a few days after he left in 2005. The medical examiner in Broward County, Florida, revealed today that prescription drugs killed former Playboy model Anna Nicole Smith. Her death was called an accidental overdose. You're listening to the Quality News Network.
Heads up, crew. This is Captain Mike from Bombardier's Lounge, World War II Big Band Jazz. I've got a book for all of you crew members interested in World War II in the air. Its title is Letters Home, Memoirs of a World War II Troop Carrier Pilot by Frank G. Hathaway. Hathaway's book is dedicated to the air crewmen who lost their lives in the Southwest Pacific, 1942 to 1946, while flying their unarmed C-46s and C-47s over the jungles, the ocean and mountains in New Guinea and the Philippines. In his book, Frank talks in his letters home about his experiences flying as a pilot with the 6th Troop Carrier Squadron, the first squadron of troop carrier planes in the Southwest Pacific. This is a book you're really going to enjoy having in your library. It's available at Amazon.com. Get this book. Ask for it by name. Letters Home by Frank G. Hathaway, published by Trafford Publishing. That's an order.
In the largest study of its kind in the U.S., the National Institutes of Health reported the more time children spent in child care, the more likely they were to have behavioral problems in the 6th grade. Intel announced it will have a much larger role in China, starting with the construction of a $2.5 billion chip factory there. The largest bank in the U.S., Citigroup, may cut 15,000 jobs, or about 5% of its workforce. According to a Census Bureau report, in February, sales of new homes dropped to the slowest pace in more than 6 years. Also, the number of homes on the market has reached a 16-year high. The Postal Service unveiled its new Forever stamp, which has an image of the Liberty Bell. The stamp will be on sale April 12th for 41 cents, which will be the new rate for first-class stamps. That rate goes into effect on May 14th. The Lundberg survey reports gasoline prices rose 5.6 cents a gallon in the past 2 weeks to an average of $2.61 per gallon for unleaded self-serve. Light sweet crude is trading just below the $63 barrel mark today. It's at $62.91. And at the close of Wall Street today, the Dow Jones was down 12 points at 12,469. The NASDAQ was up 7 points. And the S&P 500 was up 1 point. There's always more at our website, QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Allie Dramoff.
Okay, Tokyo, South America.
Now, head on with Bob Kincaid. Head On is brought to you every night by the West Virginia District Council of Carpenters and Millwrights. Union Carpenters and Millwrights, they're building the American dream. Free speech isn't free if you don't use it, so call Bob now at 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Now, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. Agnes, it's the other microphone button usually is the one that gets me going. Somebody may have, you know, the usual time that I yell, well, howdy, you know, it may have come through your microphone. I don't know, but, oh, my God, we're off to a roaring start for this, for a Monday. It feels very, very Monday all of a sudden. But that's okay. We'll get through it. We'll get over this little hump because we've got a heck of a show slated for this evening. You know how nervous I get about mentioning guests who are going to be on the program until I've actually got them hooked up on the line and I know they're going to be here. But I'll take a chance here. We are scheduled at the bottom of this hour to have Dr. Bart Ehrman, chair of the Religious Studies Department at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, who is the author of probably one of the most important texts regarding what is considered Holy Scripture among Christians ever. That book is Misquoting Jesus. In point of fact, I should mention to you that if you're interested in purchasing Misquoting Jesus, in today's show post for this show on the blog at headonradionetwork.com, somewhere on there, if you click that, there's a picture of the book at the bottom of the post. It'll take you to the Horn store, and you can order the book right there. And I don't know, I think we get 2.579681 cents per copy commission if you do so. So do so. That would just be lovely, lovely, lovely if you did. Dr. Ehrman will be on at half past the hour. And then after the news in the second hour, about 5-6 minutes past, we will be joined by my congressman, Representative Nick Joe Rahal from West Virginia's 2nd Congressional District. We'll talk a little bit about what happened this past Friday with the funding resolution. So we've got a full plate scheduled up. Although, if you want to get a few comments in before the Dr. Ehrman interview and after the Congressman Rahal interview, you are more than welcome to do so. You know you're always welcome. This is your voice, and that goes almost without saying, given the fact that I just said it. Let's start with something a little bit fun, though. It's not quite as cool as if you've got the video running with it. I'm sure many of you have seen the video of what do you call it? A mashup, a hackup, whatever. I don't know. Of George Bush doing John Lennon's Imagine. Well, he's found time to get back into the studio. Like I said, it's not quite as cool without the video, but the audio is pretty damn neat too. Whoever put this together is a genius and has literally hours and hours and hours and hours and hours on their hands with which to accomplish this kind of genius stuff. So now I give you the President of the United States, George W. Bush.
There's been a lot of talk about this next song.
This song
is not a rebel song. This song is
Sunday. Bloody Sunday.
I can't believe the news today.
Can't close my eyes
and make it
go away.
How long? How long? Must we sing this song? How long? Too long. Too long. Tonight,
we can be as one.
Tonight.
Tonight. Tonight.
Broken bottles under children's feet.
Bodies strewn across the dead
streets. But I won't leave the battle hall. It puts my back up. Puts my back up
against the wall.
Sunday.
Bloody Sunday.
Sunday,
bloody Sunday.
Sunday,
bloody Sunday.
Sunday,
bloody Sunday.
Let's roll. And the battle's just begun. This many lost. And tell me who has won.
The trenches dug within our hearts.
Mothers, children, brothers, sisters, sworn apart.
Sunday,
bloody Sunday.
Sunday,
bloody Sunday. How long? How long? As we sing this song. How long? Too long. For too long. Tonight,
we can be as one.
Tonight.
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 Sunday,
bloody Sunday.
Sunday,
bloody Sunday.
Let's roll it.
Anyone who wants more details on my agenda can find them online. The web address is not very imaginative, but it's easy to remember.
Park.
Wipe the tears from your eyes. Wipe your tears away. Wipe your tears away. Wipe your tears away. Wipe your bloodshot eyes.
Sunday,
bloody Sunday.
Sunday,
bloody Sunday.
Sunday,
bloody Sunday.
Sunday,
bloody Sunday. Let's roll it. And it's true,
not a meme.
One fact is fiction and TV reality. And today the millions cry. We eat and drink while tomorrow they die.
Sunday,
bloody Sunday.
Sunday,
bloody Sunday.
Sunday,
bloody Sunday.
Sunday,
bloody Sunday.
That's just disturbing. On about 19 dozen different levels. The video's over at YouTube. If you go over and search, you know, Sunday, Bloody Sunday, Bloody Sunday, search it, you'll find it. But there's, and most of these appear to be cuts from his State of the Union addresses. But just the way it's done almost makes it. There's something kind of gleeful, and I remember him using the word bloody, and it always seems like he's just a little bit happy about saying that word. Bloody, yum. So where do we go today? We've got a dozen different directions to go in, and I want to. We'll try to hit as many of them as we possibly can. I guess some of the newest information coming out has to do with the upcoming testimony of in regard to this little Stalinist purge that the Justice Department did, and bear in mind. Again, everything the Justice Department does now is suspect. Every last ever-loving thing it does is a matter of public suspicion and should be. Whether it's the Stephen Griles plea, where he doesn't have to drop the dime on anybody, or the Justice Department's attempt to get a sentence reduction for poor Jack Abramoff. And now you find, I found out reading a story earlier today that the prosecution of Harold Ford Jr.'s uncle, John, is it John Ford? Okay, I don't have the story right in front of me. I may have it screwed up. Anyway, Harold Ford Jr.'s uncle, who was a member of the Tennessee State Legislature and several other, on conspiracy to commit extortion, stream littering, you know, that kind of, that was, of course, an FBI sting. In fact, the name of the sting was Operation... I want a job at the FBI, or, I don't know, maybe in the Department of Defense. I want the job naming these operations. Because, honest to God, I can do better. This one in particular that nabbed... I wonder why... Harold Ford Jr.'s uncle was called Operation Tennessee Waltz. God, it's like something from W.C. Fields' The Bank Dick. If you see me and you recognize me, don't give me away. Give me the... We'll come up with a secret sign. It's Operation Tennessee Waltz. And when I call you, Agent Fred, I'll say... Would you like to dance? And Agent Fred, you'll say back, only if we do the Tennessee Waltz. What a bunch of ass clowns. So what, now here's what the dig it. Okay, now please remember, like I said, the motives of every single thing that has happened in the Justice Department, because Alberto Gonzalez and George Bush and the entire Bush administration are so hopelessly corrupted and so hopelessly compromised, every single thing they do is subject to question now. In other words, the entire federal Department of Justice system is in a shambles, to say the least. So here's what the FBI did. The FBI set up a dummy corporation. Now, the purpose of this dummy corporation was to obtain used computers from governments and schools and so forth, and then ship them overseas. Now, this corporation had no assets. It had no employees. It was, in fact, a complete, utter, and total fraud. And what the government claims that happened is that they approached some Democratic lawmakers in the Tennessee legislature who they said shook them down for money. And then they turned around and had the U.S. attorney there for, I presume, the Western District of Tennessee, seated somewhere in Memphis, Shelby County, Tennessee, something like that. They had the U.S. attorney there go in front of a grand jury, and of course, as the old saying goes, any good prosecutor worth his salt can get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich. And that's what happened. And frankly, where before I had no suspicion, now I do. Now that we know that the numbers are something, what is it, 200 and some odd Democrats were prosecuted versus 79 Republicans in political corruption cases under Alberto Gonzalez. Now that we know that, now that we know that Democrats were actively being targeted, how can we have any faith in any political corruption prosecution brought under Alberto Dr. Torture Gonzalez? And curiously enough, of course, all of this went down right as Harold Ford Jr. was announcing his candidacy for the United States Senate in a race that he ultimately lost by scarce percentage points to a guy whose political ads used jungle drums every time they mentioned Harold Ford's name, being Bob Corker. That's Bob, my daughters are gone wild, Corker. So, Everything is broken at the Department of Justice, and that's a real shame because it's sort of like, that a tennis ball has been put in, you know, Justice, the image, you know, with the blindfold and the sword and the scales. Well, she's got a tennis ball in her mouth now, and it's taped around her head, and she's just kind of, you know, because of these sick, kinky, revolting Republicans. You know, the lady with the sword and the scales and the blindfold has been replaced by the see no evil, speak no evil, hear no evil monkeys. God. And now we find out that the woman who is counsel to Alberto Gonzalez, Alberto Gonlawless, the lady who is his counsel, who will be called to testify before a Senate committee on the Stalinist purge in the Justice Department, well, guess what she's going to do? That's right. Monica Gooding. Where do they get these names? Monica Gooding says that she's going to take the Fifth. Now, she's a lawyer. They're already all lawyered up, by the way. So she's Gonzalez's lawyer, and she's got a lawyer, and Monica Gooding, her lawyer, says that she's not going to testify because senators have already decided that wrongdoing occurred. Excuse me. I thought that the Fifth Amendment protections applied to self-incrimination, not to whatever some senator has decided already occurred. But, you know, she's good. She's going to be a good soldier. She's going to follow Omerta. And she's going to dummy up in front of the United States Senate. Just beautiful, isn't it? Wait a minute. Wait. When they were tapping our phones, and they said, well, if you're a good American, you have nothing to worry about because you have nothing to hide. How about you, Monica Gooding? Are you a good American? If you've done nothing wrong, sweetheart, you've got nothing to hide. You know, this isn't a criminal trial. This is simply a matter of trying to find out what happened in this bizarre little escapade that Alberto Gonzalez said on March 13th that he knew nothing about, but it turns out that he was at a meeting over it and formally approved on November 27th. They told him everything that was going on. Oh, yeah, go do it. I like that one. I'm a loyal Bushy. Oh. Jeez. You know, you can't make this stuff up. Let's go to the phones. We're joined by our good friend Jim calling from a remote undisclosed location. Hey, Jim, welcome to the program.
Okay, well, you've been reading Alberto's email?
Well, no, they just send it to me. I get blind copied on it.
I see. I still think you would look great, Poncho Villa.
Yeah, with the little bandoliers and a poncho.
Yeah, and a mustache. And I think he's on his way out.
I'd like to hope he is, but by the you kind of wish he'd stick around just to be another punching bag.
Well, we'll just wait and see.
I just can't wait for him to get in front of the Senate and say badges. We don't need no stinking badges.
By the way, you're talking about Harold Ford.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I liked Harold Ford a lot, but Harold Ford, in addition to assuming a role with the Democratic Party, he's got some kind of chairman job there. He's also gone over to Fox News.
So I'd read. I haven't seen him there.
Well, no, he said he was. I heard him say it.
Ick.
So, I mean, he and Don Imus are good buddies.
Well, Harold's a little conservative for my taste, frankly, but he certainly beat the living dickens out of having that goober Bob Corker in office.
Oh, yeah, well.
And, you know, Corker showed where his sympathies lay with his ugly, vile little racist ads. And I hope nobody will ever forget that or forgive him for it.
Well, I just wondered. I was kind of shocked that Harold Ford would be going over to Fox News. But, I mean, you know, guy's got to make a living.
Yeah, and I guess it's a question of how big a check Fox writes.
Well, Rupert Murdoch has very deep pockets, that's for sure.
Yes, he does. And the last I checked, his checks don't bounce.
No, they don't. But anyway, that's all I had to say. Really.
Yeah, it was Harold. You know, Harold's uncle. Well, I mean, are you? Do you believe the Justice Department at this point is compromised?
Do I believe they're compromised?
Yeah.
I think there might be a slight element of compromise there. I think that, you know, with them, as they say, said lex duralex, of always latex.
Yeah. Well, they've sort of treated it that way, haven't they?
Well, yeah, I think they have. I mean, you know, they basically, this whole administration has just done exactly what it wants to do. And they've just been absolutely, there's been no governance whatsoever.
Well, only to the extent that any governance that has gone down this has been government for profit.
Oh, absolutely.
And
it's just incredible how, like I've said many times before, we have the best government money can buy.
Well, in a way, I would almost be satisfied if that were the case, Jim. Unfortunately, the money's not buying any competence. I mean, this is just plain old pig-eyed, swine-headed greed. They don't care what we get out of it, as long as they get both the front and the back feet in the trough.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, like I say, they've gotten to the point now that they've become so excessive that this is one of the elements of their own self-destruction that's beginning to manifest itself. You know, I really believe that George Bush is not going to finish out his last term. I believe something's going to happen to bring him down.
Well, you know, I've wondered how long it would take, Jim, because one of the things you hear is, well, you know, we can't impeach him now. We couldn't have the proceedings over with by the time he leaves office.
Well, I don't know. I just think that Mr. Bush has committed done so many things that, I don't know.
Is he going to get his war with Iran? You know he wants one, Jim.
No. He won't get that. If he does, I'll be quite surprised.
Well, you know, give me a little hope here. What's
what he did with Iraq, and you know, basically Iraq now is just completely splintered apart, and you know, for what purpose would he fight a war with Iraq?
Iran, you mean?
I mean Iran.
For what purpose would he fight a war with Iraq?
Other than the fact, well, I mean,
he likes war.
Well, that's the reason people, you know, well, so did Adolf Hitler, until people realized what the hell he was talking about and how they couldn't be trusted. And how he could not, you know, be trusted to keep his word or to even... Nobody believes him anymore. I mean, Bush doesn't realize it, but no one's wearing him this year. He is totally out of fashion, and people are tired of this this business of all this money being spent for war and for nothing. I mean, the only thing we can do with Iraq, for example, is to split that country into several actions where they did COPASO with a weak central government and hope that'll work. That's about the only solution I know for that part of the world. I mean, it's sort of like a miniature Yugoslavia after, you know, Yugoslavia collapsed into Bosnia, Croatia, and Herzegovina. That's what's happened to Iraq. Now, with Iran, I don't think the military is going to go for that, because we can't prosecute a war with those people. There's no way.
Well, I read somewhere the other day that the 101st Airborne was supposed to be our ready division. You know, anytime, anywhere, get up and go. Well, it turns out we've shipped so many of those to Iraq that they're no longer capable of being that.
No, they're not. They're no longer mission capable, and they're no longer able to maintain that level of readiness.
And so they've shifted that status to the 84th, and the 84th. But the 84th is like
so
air cav.
The 81st or the 84th air cavalry.
Yeah, they're air cav, and they can't deliver paratroops, according to what I read. Whereas the 101st.
Well, they were, you know, those guys in the 101st, when they left their office, they just jumped out of their windows and into the back seat of their car.
Yeah, a bunch of guys who like to go around jumping out of perfectly good aircraft. But no, they can't be the ready division anymore. They're broken. The whole military's broken.
Well, of course it is. I mean, it's been overextended, and it's not designed. It has been used in a way that it is not designed to be used. I mean, primarily, it's being used as a... The military is not there to be a police force or a nation-building force. And, you know, it is neither. I mean, they do have civil affairs units and things of that nature that are designed to keep order in a very short period of time. And they do have engineers, but the engineers are there for a stopgap measure until the local people can take over and, you know, things can return back to normal. And then we have other people do that sort of work. But the way they have screwed up the military with the contracting and the privatization of it, our military has been so privatized that it's hard to think of who does what.
It can't get its own mail and it can't cook its own meals.
Or do its own laundry.
Jim, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Good night, sir.
You take care.
Out of here.
All right. That's kind of pathetic, isn't it? That's how far George Bush has taken us. The mightiest, most profound military force on the planet. And it can't cook its own meals, can't do its own laundry, and can't get the mail to the troops because it's all been privatized. Jumping Jupiter. We're half past the hour. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, gosh, I hope we've got Dr. Ehrman. Sometimes you just have to hope. You're listening to America's Liberal Voice. You're listening, well, it's your voice. This is the Head On Radio Network, The Horn. And I'm Bob Kincaid.
The Head On Radio Network is brought to you every night by the Carpenters and Millwrights. The Mid-Atlantic Regional Council of Carpenters is a portion of the United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Joiners of America, or more commonly called the Carpenters Union. The millwrights are a very specialized craft that perform their work with highly sensitive equipment and perform much of their work on machinery like turbines, laser alignment, and other highly specialized tools. We would like to thank the Carpenters and Millwrights for their support, because freedom of speech is free. And it's brought to you by the Carpenters and Millwrights, working hard every day to provide a brighter future. Thank you from the Head On Radio Network.
Do you believe the environment is issue number one? Does the idea of genetically modified food cause you to lose your appetite? Do you prefer green over greed? Do rising sea levels and vanishing polar ice cause you concern about our planet and what we are doing to it? Would you like news with attitude on the environment, organics, renewable sources of energy? Well, then join me, John Fox, for Foxed Up. Weekdays, 5 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Pacific, 10 p.m. in the UK, and 9 a.m. here in Sydney. Where conversation radio becomes conservation radio. And we turn it straight up to 11. Right here on the Head On Radio Network.
Here's a test for you. Listen and identify the following water-saving devices in your home. Ready? That's the sound of water-saving device number 54, your toothbrush. Turning the water off while you brush your teeth saves more than 1,000 gallons a year. Next, that's your clock. Water-saving device number 23. Use it to reduce your shower by 5 minutes and save nearly 9,000 gallons a year. Try this one. Right, it's water-saving device number 83, your washing machine. Washing full loads of laundry or dishes can save thousands of gallons of water each year. Last clue. That's you, logging on to WaterUseItWisely.com, a fun website filled with hundreds of water-saving tips from your local water utility and the Metropolitan Washington Council of Governments. There are a number of ways to save water, and they all start with you. Water. Use it wisely.
Alrighty then. 24 minutes and a half before the hour. And we are at present still waiting to hear from Dr. Ehrman. In the meantime, however, let's I mentioned this late on Friday night's program. This is important stuff, especially here in the hills and hollers of West Virginia. But it's important to everybody who cares what actually happens, what goes on behind the scenes when you turn your computer on, when you flip the switch and the light just comes on. When the little miracle that we don't pay attention to, i.e. the refrigerator and the freezer keep being cold or frozen, for everyone for whom that matters, something important happened Friday. And that was the ruling by U.S. District Judge Chuck Chambers in federal court to the effect that the Army Corps of Engineers illegally issued permits for 4 mountaintop removal mines without adequately determining whether the environment would be harmed. Now, the Corps maintained all along that, they didn't need to do environmental impact statements or any of that kind of squishy, liberal environmental stuff. No, they didn't need to do that. No, they felt like they could just fast-track it. So, as a consequence, they were taken to court by my good friends at Coal River Mountain Watch, by the Highlands Conservancy, and by the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition. And once again, as has happened 2 other times, we won. Common sense prevails at the trial court level. And, of course, I'm sure the Army Corps of Engineers will appeal. But for now, we put it in the W column. It's a win. And one of these days, the lights will go on, literally, for the rest of the nation, and we'll realize that somehow or another, using a Hiroshima's worth of explosives on the oldest mountains on Earth every week is not the best way to make sure that Aunt Molly's refrigerator keeps running. So congratulations to our friends at OVEC, at Coal River Mountain Watch, at the Highlands Conservancy. You're doing the most important work of all, saving future generations. We are joined on the phone now by Dr. Bart Ehrman, author of Misquoting Jesus, a fabulous book, an eye-opening book, and a book that just took me by storm when I read it. Dr. Ehrman, thank you very much for joining us, and welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me.
I was just reading Sam Harris's little tome, Letter to a Christian Nation, and I think you're number 2 on his books you must read list at the end of that book.
Yeah, well, you know, I think actually that Harris book is terrific, and I gave it to both my children as Christmas presents. And my son said it was the best Christmas present he ever received.
It is fabulous, but it's the fact that he relies apparently so heavily on what you put into Misquoting Jesus that moves me. Now, I was raised, Dr. Ehrman, in the South. I describe myself as a recovering Southern Baptist, And a lot of the things that you address in your book were things that were taught to me as infallible and unquestionable.
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit about the nature of what it is that you do. You do textual criticism of New Testament what you call witnesses. What does that entail?
Well, what it entails is trying to understand what the authors of the New Testament originally wrote, given the fact that we don't have the originals of any of the books of the New Testament. All we have are copies that were made later. In most cases, these copies were made many hundreds of years later. And the problem is all of these copies that we have changes in them. They're all different from one another. And so the textual critic tries to decide where, when you have these differences, what the original text was and where you've had scribes change the text.
And it's safe to say, I think you noted in the text of your book, there are more mistakes in the New Testament than words in it?
Yeah, there are more differences in the manuscripts than there are words in the New Testament. So that this is an enormous problem because there are places where scholars debate what the original text originally said, and there are some places where we don't know what the original text said. That obviously causes a problem for a lot of readers because they just assume that when they read the Gospel of Mark or Paul's letter to the Galatians, that they're reading his original words. But we don't know in some cases what the original words were.
In many ways, it would be as if, when you're talking about the distance between, say, the crucifixion and the first the texts that we're aware of, it would and what happens with the scribes in between that period of time, it would be as if we were sitting in 2007 United States of America and all convinced that the Declaration of Independence said, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created unequal.
Well, that's right. I mean, suppose we don't have any copies of the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution. Suppose we don't have any copies that exist until a copy that turns up this week. And suppose we have lots of copies that turn up this week, but they all disagree with one another. Well, we'd have quite a task on our hands trying to figure out what the Founding Fathers were trying to say. And it's exactly that problem with the New Testament. We have lots of manuscripts. We have thousands of manuscripts, but the earliest ones we have are, the very earliest ones are decades removed from the originals, and the vast majority of manuscripts are centuries removed from the originals.
Well, with that being the case, like I said, I was raised in a church where this is not questioned. At best, we can argue over nuance, but certainly not validity. Where does this idea come from of inerrant scripture?
Well, the idea that scripture is inerrant is very popular in the South, in America, but what most people don't realize who hold to the view of inerrancy is that, in fact, that's a modern creation. It's a theological belief that most Christians throughout history never held on to. The first discussions of the Bible being inerrant actually come from the early 20th century. And so this is it's a modern belief, which I think it strikes me as very strange because I I'm in the South as well, and people, I've heard people say that if you don't believe every word in the Bible, then you cannot be a Christian, which is very strange historically because Christians for many, many centuries didn't believe every word in the Bible. So this is a unique cultural phenomenon, I think.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the sorts of problems that you have run up against in your examination of the New Testament. It's my understanding there are a couple of different ways that error can enter the text, i.e. inadvertently versus intentional.
Yes, well, among these manuscripts we have, there are hundreds of thousands of differences. But the vast majority of them are, as you're saying, inadvertent or just accidental. Probably the vast majority of them are simply show that scribes in antiquity can't spell any better than most of us can today. They're just spelling differences, which really don't matter for very much. So there are a lot of that kind of accidental change. But there are also some changes that look like they were made intentionally when scribes were trying to change the text in order to alter what it actually said. And those changes, they're not as numerous, but they're far more interesting and significant because in some places the scribes changed the text so successfully that people have come to think that the changed text is the original when in fact it probably is not.
Off the cuff, can you give us an example of that?
Well, one of the most famous examples is the story found in John chapter 7 and 8 about the woman taken in adultery. This is the famous story where Jesus tells her accusers, let the one without sin among you be the first to cast a stone at her. It's a gorgeous story. It's a terrific story, but unfortunately it's not in any of our earliest manuscripts of John. This is a story that was added later by scribes. So it's probably something that didn't happen, and it's almost certainly something that wasn't originally in the Gospels.
Well, what about the resurrection story in Mark? Is that an add-on too?
Yeah, that's another interesting one. In Mark's Gospel, Mark is my favorite Gospel in part because of the way it ends. The way Mark's Gospel ends is Jesus has been crucified and buried, and on the third day, the women go to the tomb, and they see a young man there who tells them that Jesus has been raised from the dead, and they're to go tell the disciples to meet Jesus in Galilee. And then it says, the women fled from the tomb and didn't say anything to anyone, for they were afraid. And that's where it ends, period, in our oldest and best manuscript. That's the ending. Well, some scribes read that and thought, how in the world could it end there? And so they added 12 additional verses that you'll find in Bibles today, but usually the Bibles today will put these additional 12 verses in brackets to show they weren't original. It's in these 12 additional verses that Jesus tells his followers that they're to go out and make disciples, and that if anyone believes in him, they'll be able to drink deadly poison and it won't hurt them, and they'll be able to handle snakes. And so this is where the Appalachian snake handlers get their theology from these 12 verses in Mark that were not originally in the Gospel of Mark.
Is there some possibility that this was maybe the earliest text that doesn't have it in there? Maybe a piece of papyrus fell off, or a leaf was gone from a folio, or
yeah, that's absolutely possible. I mean, another option is that there was an ending, a longer ending, and that the last page just kind of disappeared. And so that's one of the options. If that's the case, then what we have is a situation where we don't know what the original text actually said. Because it's been permanently lost. So some scholars think that, and some scholars think that it actually ended with women not saying anything to anyone, which makes pretty good sense in Mark's Gospel when you look at it as a literary unit. But virtually nobody thinks that those last 12 verses are original.
Well, what does that do to any attempt to all of these changes? What does it do to the validity or the viability of all the doctrine and dogma that's built up around it?
Right. Well, you know, different people have different evaluations of this. So the kind of things I talk about in my book, Misquoting Jesus, those sorts of things are well known to evangelical Christian scholars who know all about this because they study it the way that anybody who studies the Bible in Greek does. And so it's not that this is just a point of view, you know, held by liberal scholars or by agnostic scholars or anything. Everybody knows this about the text. The problem is that people in the pew don't know it, or people on the street don't know it. What evangelical scholars would say is that even though you have all of these hundreds and thousands of differences, they don't affect any major doctrine of Christianity. And what I say about it is something slightly different, which is that some of these changes actually affect how you interpret entire books of the New Testament. So the interpretation of Luke depends on which manuscripts you follow, or the interpretation of John depends on which manuscripts you follow. And so it strikes me as being rather important to know what each of these authors had to say, because if you don't know what they had to say, then you don't know what they meant. If you don't know what they meant, then it's very hard to build theology on them.
Well, what about Paul's letters? We've limited ourselves thus far pretty much to the Gospels. What about do we have better witnesses in terms of Paul's Gospels?
Yeah,
or Paul's letters. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's true actually for all of the New Testament that you've got for Paul's letters, for the other letters, for the Book of Revelation, the Book of Acts. The entire New Testament is in the same situation, which is that we don't have very ancient text. In other words, we don't have texts from the time that the authors actually wrote the text, but we have copies that are In Paul's case, we have copies that are, for example, from about the year 200. Paul was writing in the 50s, and so the earliest complete copies we have of Paul's, and these aren't completely, absolutely complete, but the earliest full copies we have of Paul's letters are about 150 years after his day. So that's 150 years of people copying this text and presumably changing it in places.
And with that being the case, you know, I mean, I've read the New Testament. I don't do Greek. I got Latin, but no Greek. And that being the case, I've always wondered as I read, and I'm sure many others have as well, whether or not we're reading what it really says. The one that comes to mind almost most quickly is, you know, the old business about, you know, Jesus was a carpenter like his daddy, and it says carpenter, but no, lo and behold, it says the Greek is technon, and that's not carpenter.
that's a whole other problem. The Greek word there, tekton, is a word that means it means somebody who works with their hands, and so it might be a stonemason, it could be a blacksmith, or it could be a carpenter. The word's applied to Jesus in only one verse. It's in Mark chapter 6, verse 3. And what's interesting is here again, scribes have changed the text. There are a lot of manuscripts that instead of saying that Jesus was the tekton, they say that his father was the tekton. And so in those manuscripts, you don't have any reference to Jesus' occupation in Mark or in any of the other gospels. So again, scribes are changing their text. The reason, by the way, they'd probably want to change that text is because it was widely thought in the ancient world that being a tekton was a kind of a lower class occupation. And so, you know, they might have thought it wasn't suitable for the Son of God. The kind of feel that term had for ancient people would be like us saying Jesus was a construction worker. You know, so he's
or one of the guys who goes out and does day labor out of the Home Depot parking lot.
Yeah, that's right. Or somebody who's, you know, kind of, you know, I don't know. I mean, just some guy who's on the street crew or something.
Yeah, and if you've just devoted 250, 300 years to developing an entire religion, it's a bit demeaning, isn't it?
Well, you know, the question was, is that a suitable occupation for the Son of God? And some scribes thought that it probably wasn't.
Well, what about the Son of... And ultimately, I guess this becomes one of the most pertinent questions. What about the Son of God? What about versus Son of Man versus all the other references? Do we have any way of knowing where it is in, you know, if you think about a red letter edition of the Gospels, for instance, do we have any way of knowing where it is that you reliably got the words of Jesus?
Well, it's very difficult, and it's not only because scribes have changed the text. Because, you know, I mean, textual critics can come up with, in most cases, they know what the original text said, but not all cases. But the other problem is that the authors of the New Testament who are writing down the words of Jesus are writing down these words 30, 40, 50 years after Jesus lived. The earliest gospel we have is Mark, and he was writing about 35 years after Jesus' death. And he's writing in a different language from Jesus. Jesus spoke in Aramaic, and Mark was writing in Greek. And so what's happened is that the stories about Jesus' teachings have been in circulation by word of mouth year after year after year before anybody writes them down. As anybody knows, stories that get handed on by word of mouth tend to change. And so it's an enormous problem knowing whether Mark actually had any access to the literal words of Jesus. Then once Mark writes them down, the problem is we don't have a copy of Mark's gospel for another 150 years. So it makes matters really complicated for people who want to know what Jesus really said.
This may be an overly facile question, Dr. Ehrman, but what happened to the early copies?
Oh, it's not a facile question at all. It's a terrifically interesting question. And I wish we knew the answer to it. My guess is that when people in the early church had an original copy, say, of Mark's gospel, somebody in the church copied it, and they thought, well, why do we need the original now? We have a copy. So the original probably was used so much it just got worn out or eventually thrown away, and they didn't see the point of keeping it because For one thing, they probably didn't realize that the church was going to be around for 2,000 more years.
Well, they were kind of expecting to be leaving any day now.
Yeah, any day now. And so they weren't really that keen about keeping things for posterity. And so I'm afraid all these books got thrown away, probably, or destroyed, or somehow lost.
Well, that takes us to another very, very interesting topic, and one that seems to be consuming the American people, and that is this end times eschatology. Where does all that stuff come from?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of it in the New Testament. You know, in the Gospel of Mark, our earliest gospel, Jesus tells his own disciples that some of them won't taste death before they see that the kingdom of God has come in power. And the disciples want to know when the end of the world's going to come, and he tells them this generation won't pass away before all these things take place. And so, you know.
And he meant that generation, I mean, presumably.
I assume that's what he meant. That's who he was talking to. And I think that this idea that the end is near goes all the way back in early Christianity to Jesus himself. But that Jesus didn't come up with this idea. There were a lot of Jews in Jesus' day who thought that the end was right around the corner, and that God was going to intervene and overthrow the forces of evil to bring in a good kingdom on earth. And so, I think Jesus was one of these apocalyptic preachers.
And to a certain extent, many of them were correct if you consider what happened, 72 A.D.?
Yeah, some people have thought that the fall of Jerusalem maybe is what Jesus was talking about, although what Jesus actually says is the sun will turn black, and the moon will turn to blood, and the stars will fall from the sky. And the fall of Jerusalem was significant, but it wasn't quite that significant.
Not quite there. Do you consider what you do, is this an attack on faith, or a way of shining a light on the errancy of the Bible, or... because, you know, what you said earlier is very, very true. The evangelicals know everything that you're telling me.
Yeah.
But they're not telling the marks in the pews.
No, they're not, are they? Well, I don't see it as an attack on faith. I think it is an attack on fundamentalist faith, because I think it's very hard to be a fundamentalist if you understand where the Bible actually came from. But it's not hard to be a believing Christian and know this material. I learned this material at Princeton Theological Seminary, which is a seminary training Presbyterian ministers, and so they all heard this material and they went out and they preached in churches, and they're all, you know, they're faithful Christians. And so I don't think this material will make an unbeliever out of anybody, or at least it shouldn't. I myself became an agnostic over the years, even though I started out as an evangelical Christian, but it wasn't because I found that there were mistakes in the manuscripts. It was for a whole different set of reasons. I think the fact that there are mistakes in the manuscripts simply means that you can't trust every word literally of the New Testament as being having been given directly from God.
You know, that's a very simple statement and a very cogent statement, and there are people out there who would punch your lights out for saying it, and mine too.
Yeah, well, you know,
I mean, it's disturbing.
Read violence.
Yeah, it's disturbing that we live in a culture like that. Well, just as a final thought, I have to. Ever since I knew that we were going to be having this conversation, maybe this is one of those great little stories that gets passed around in biblical criticism cocktail parties. But one of my favorite jokes out there is the one of the young novice and the old abbot, who are there in the monastery, and the young novice is going to start copying manuscripts, and he looks at the abbot and says, "Well, Father, why don't we use the originals instead of me copying copies? What if there's a mistake in here?" And the old abbot scratches his head and says, "Goodness me, what a thought." He says, "Come with me," and they go down into the catacombs. And he says, "Wait here, I'll get the original." And a little bit later, the young novice hears the old abbot screaming. And he says, "Father, Father, what's wrong?" And he's got the scroll open, and he says, "Boy, it says celebrate."
Yep.
But that's really kind of what you're talking about here.
Yes, indeed.
You know, one letter.
One letter makes a big difference, absolutely.
I thank you so much. And just one last question. Where does something like, because I know you were involved in the Gospel of Judas. My God, it was a detective story, for heaven's sakes. But in the recovery and restoration of the Gospel of Judas, I know you had somewhat of a hand in that. Where does something like Judas or the Gospel of St. Thomas fit in all of this?
Well, these are Gospels that didn't make it into the New Testament, and they have the same problem as the Gospels that did make it in, which is that we don't have the originals of them. In the case of both Judas and Thomas, we don't even have a copy in the original language. Both of these books were originally written in Greek, but now they survive only in the Egyptian language, Coptic. But, you know, these things turn up every now and then, and they're highly significant and very interesting. So my more recent book, since I did miss quoting Jesus, I wrote another book on the Gospel of Judas Iscariot, which was just made public this last April. It's a very interesting gospel and very different from the ones that made it into the New Testament.
And oddly enough, for somebody like me raised in a fundamentalist, you know, Southern Baptist church in the South, I always had this lingering idea that Judas was getting a raw deal somewhere along the way.
Well, that's right. And the Gospel of Judas is the first ancient text that actually says that. I mean, it doesn't come out and say it explicitly, but it's the clear implication of the text that Judas is the good guy, and he's not the villain of the story.
But Jesus also looks at him and says, nobody's going to get it.
Yeah, but then he takes Judas aside, and he explains it all to Judas. And so, strangely enough, Judas is the one of the disciples who gets it. Yeah,
It's absolutely fascinating. I had a few courses in this when I was going to school at West Virginia, and it really, really stuck. And I would suggest that with misquoting Jesus, you have, and I assume there are a lot more like me, you have opened eyes and, among other things, made this approachable and made this accessible and made it possible for people to sit down and read with an open heart and an open mind and an open eye, which I take it was your goal.
Yep, it was. So I'm glad it's had that effect.
Well, Dr. Ehrman, what is the latest book, by the way? Let's let folks know that too.
Well, the latest one is called The Secret Gospel of Judas Iscariot.
Okay, and that's out now?
It's out, yeah.
Okay, wonderful. Well, I hope folks will go out and pick up both. Like I said, I got hold of Misquoting Jesus. Now I've got to go get the Judas book.
Okay.
Fascinating stuff. Congratulations on your new grandchild.
Oh, thanks.
And thank you very, very much, Dr. Ehrman, for joining us. I hope again, maybe sometime the next book, we'll have a conversation about that as well. This has been wonderful.
Great. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Take care.
All right.
Bye now. Dr. Bart Ehrman, author of The Secret Gospel of Judas Iscariot and Misquoting Jesus. If you want to understand how things got, because, you know, he's right. They're not telling the chumps in the pews. Bless her heart, I've got a 92-year-old neighbor who's waiting for Jesus to come for her. He ain't coming. It ain't going to happen. No golden Rolls Royce in the clouds. It ain't there. It's not in the book. It's not in the scripture. It's not in the script. But there's a lot there to enlighten. There's a lot there that's fascinating. And if you like the couple of things that Dr. Ehrman touched on, there's a bunch more in the book. And if you will go to the show post for today's program at the blog at headonradionetwork.com and click on the picture of the book, it'll take you to somewhere that you can buy the book, and we'll get 2.79612 cents on the sale. Or you know what? Do what I did. Take advantage of a magnificent resource that exists in this country. Go ye unto thy public library and borrow thou that yonder book. Because, you see, the ancient world had one public library for all intents and purposes at Alexandria. Once upon a time, there was a country called the United States of America that thought that it was a good idea to have libraries all over the place, and that it would be a really, really good use of our public funds to make sure that they were good, accessible libraries for everyone. It's not so much the case anymore. My good friend, the librarian, recently got called in. You know, you're doing a whale of a bang-up job. This is a great library. You're doing good. Now go and tell your part-timers that we're cutting their hours because our funding's been cut. Imagine that. Imagine a nation where multi-million dollar bombs are more important than knowledge, than learning, than scholarship, than the filling of young minds and old alike. Imagine a nation where guns are more important than brains. And these goobers on the right say that they're pro-life? Mama. Tell you what, we're a little late getting to it, but we'll go to the news. Coming up, a conversation with Congressman Nick Joe Rahal. Stick around. You're listening to America's liberal voice, The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Sometimes I feel I've got to run away. I've got to get away from the pain you drive into the heart of me. The love we share seems to go nowhere. And I've lost my light, for I toss and turn, I can't sleep at night. Once I ran to you, now I'll run from you. This tainted love you've given, I give you all a boy could give you. Take my tears, and that's not nearly all. Tainted love, tainted love.
This is the Quality News Network. The former chief of staff to Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez will testify Thursday about the controversial firings of 8 U.S. prosecutors. Kyle Sampson, who recently resigned, will appear before the Senate Judiciary Committee. The Associated Press reports another Justice Department official involved, Monica Golding, will invoke the Fifth Amendment and refuse to answer the senator's questions. And investigators now say there was no criminal negligence in the friendly fire death of former football star turned Army Ranger Pat Tillman. Tillman was shot to death in Afghanistan in 2004. The Defense Department released the results of their investigation today. Iran is under increased pressure to release the 15 British sailors and Marines seized Friday in the Gulf waters. Tehran insists they were in Iranian waters, while Britain insists they were in Iraqi waters. Iran says it is interrogating the British forces. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon and Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice are both in the Middle East for peace talks. Israel now favors the idea of a regional peace summit. In Northern Ireland, an historic agreement has been reached between Protestant and Catholic political leaders. It will end 3 decades of sectarian conflict. Under the deal, the power-sharing government will start on May 8th. The suicide attack Friday against Iraq's Sunni deputy prime minister was likely an inside job carried out by at least one of his own security detail. The politician was seriously wounded and 9 of his bodyguards were killed. In central Baghdad today, 2 people were killed by a suicide car bomb blast. 5 were wounded. The presidents of Russia and China today, 2 of Iran's closest allies, are urging Iran to fulfill the UN Security Council's demands to halt its uranium enrichment program. This weekend, the UN Security Council issued its latest sanctions against Iran. And in Pakistan, more than 1,000 people have been arrested for taking part in opposition rallies against President Pervez Musharraf. In Egypt also today, few voters showed up at the polls to vote on a referendum on major constitutional changes increasing police state powers. You're listening to the Quality News Network. Science and Business News next.
It's your second hour in the liberal sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
Welcome back. 9 minutes after the hour, I'm Bob. And we are an hour into another week of classic progressive liberal conversation on the horn. We're joined at this point in time by my congressman. Proud to say that. Congressman Nick Rahal, 2nd District of West Virginia. Congressman Rahal, are you there?
Yes, Bob, I am.
Really good to talk to you again.
Thank thank you. You went out just a minute there, but did you say 2nd District?
I didn't mean to say 2nd District.
Okay, 3rd District.
3rd
right.
District. You know, I got it's just too late in the day. 3rd District. I had 2nd District on the brain because I've been watching what your colleague, Ms. Capito, has been up to, so I'm sorry. She's a problem for us, but I'll say that, and that way you won't have to. But Congressman, I'm glad you could take a moment to join us. The vote that took place on Friday with regard to the war and the emergency, so-called emergency supplemental spending bill, there is a lot of back and forth in the progressive and the liberal community over whether this is a victory or a defeat. Would you care to chime in on it?
Yes, I will, Bob. I think it's a victory. It's a victory, number one, for our troops. This was a vote in support of troops and in support of our veterans and in support of those who have returned from service in Iraq to ensure that they get quality health care, that they get taken care of by the American people at a time when we're creating more veterans than ever before. So we put our brave soldiers first, and I believe that this Congress has that duty, and I believe that's what we did in this supplemental.
What about the issue of ending this nightmare?
Well, there are deadlines set in this supplemental. There are deadlines based upon requiring the Iraqis to do certain things every step of the way, and if they don't, then we leave. I believe this is a victory for those wanting to end the war. For the first time, Congress is on record as putting a date certain when troops should be withdrawn. It's very clear that this gives our commanders on the ground leverage that they perhaps cannot seek on their own, but now we have a hammer over the Iraqis to say, you must get your house in order, you must control the insurgents, you must help us help you by turning over your security to you so that we can go home. The commanders can now say you have Congress on record as being in favor of deadlines. Now, we're not advocating that, but look what's behind our back if you don't help us help you. So I believe this is a victory in that regard to helping bring our troops home sooner rather than later.
Well, I have. It's been my personal feeling, Congressman, that if we let this thing, and I'm not talking about politicizing anything, it's just it seems to me observable fact, if we let President Bush do what he has already said and hand this war off to whoever the next occupant of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue is, those of us who earnestly yearn for a Democratic president are almost hamstringing that president and dooming that person to be the one that, so that the Republicans can say, well, see, y'all lost the war, we didn't.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, do you see what I'm saying by that?
Yes, I do, and I hope and pray that that doesn't happen. The president, the current status quo obviously is not working. It's no longer a viable option. We all agree on that. And by what the Congress is doing here, we're saying to the president, the status quo is not working. Surge or no surge, it's not working, because this latest surge is certainly nothing new. It's more of the same. It's the status quo. And we have to take a new direction. I believe that's what the American people voted for last November. And this Congress is taking a new direction in this war. And for us to have passed this as we did, timelines included, timelines for withdrawal, and to have got it through a very divided, in the beginning, no longer so divided, Democratic Congress, where you had members of Congress from military districts, Democrats, I might add, representing strongly pro-military districts of this nation, voting in favor of this bill. That's quite a victory.
That is an accomplishment. The president has already said, Congressman, that he's going to veto this if it gets to him looking anything remotely like what the House passed. If he does that, and it comes back to you, at some point, and please, I try to think of these things in the simplest terms that I possibly can, Congressman. At what point does it become incumbent upon the Congress and incumbent upon the American people to look at George Bush and say, listen, you had a run at Arbusto Energy and you messed that up. You had a run at Harkin Energy and you messed that up. You had a run at Spectrum 7 Energy and you messed that up. And now you've had a run at the American economy and you've messed that up. And we gave you the power to go to war in a foreign country thousands and thousands of miles away and you've messed that up. You gotta stop. If he vetoes it, do you think it'll come? Will it come back to him? Or at this point in time, do we get to start asking George Bush, like they've asked people like me who are opposed to the war? Do we get to start asking George Bush why he hates the troops?
Well, if he will veto this, it's not if, but when he vetoes this, and it comes back to us, the pressure will be on from the commanders to come up with a supplemental for the troops soon. Very soon, because they cannot continue without funding. The president will continue to use his bully pulpit, as he does so often, to make it look like the Democrats then will not be supporting our troops if we don't vote for a clean emergency supplemental. There's got to be a meeting of the minds somewhere in between on this. The president wants a clean bill. That's not going to happen. So we'll have to see what the president is willing to accept in the way of timelines, in the way of increased care for our troops, in the way of body armor and other Humvees and other equipment necessary to ensure that those he's sending over there are taken care of, which is what our supplemental did, as well as those that return in very impaired physical condition. We have that obligation as well. And we've gone beyond what the president's added, for example, for veterans' health care, and we've got to find that middle ground for a funding bill.
To a certain extent, does this become a media issue? And I ask that from the standpoint of people who oppose the war. We've been accused of not supporting the troops when we want to support them so much. We want them home where they can't get blown up by IEDs. There's this notion somehow that if they're not, that if we try to get out of this war, that somehow we're going to leave a bunch of American soldiers walking around the streets of Baghdad with no bullets in their guns. That's just not true.
No, you're right. It's not true, Bob. And there's a lot of false impressions being spewed on this issue, a lot of rhetoric. The president, of course, has the ultimate bully pulpit in the in that he can get press attention at the drop of a needle when others, like the Congress, cannot get such attention. What is truly hypocritical about this whole issue are the number of Republicans last week that spoke out against our supplemental, trying to spin this vote as something other than a vote in support of our troops, trying to spin it as a party of cut and run or banding our troops. That ironically, these same Republicans that spoke last week, some of them, supported timelines and benchmarks and other requirements on the conflict in Bosnia when President Clinton was in office, where the United States had not suffered a single casualty, in contrast to the 3,200 in Iraq, where America had only been involved for a mere 18 months, mm-hmm. as opposed to 4 years in Iraq, and had only spent around $7 billion. As opposed to $379 billion in Iraq and counting. And yet these same Republicans that voted to impose timelines and withdrawal deadlines for our troops in that conflict are now saying, opposing it and spinning it as a vote that's cut and run in this particular war. It's just so ironic, and yet that doesn't receive the attention I think it deserves.
Well, it seems so long ago now, Congressman, but I remember Senator Trent Lott standing in the well of the Senate and flailing about and saying, with regard to the war in Kosovo, I can support the troops without supporting this president.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't understand why the American people put up with a level of hypocrisy like that. Now, you, coming as you do from West Virginia, You know very well what the needs of people around here are, and they're not that different from needs in other parts of the country. If we want to fix Katrina, if we want the Gulf Coast to recover from Katrina, or if we want good roads in West Virginia, or if we want viable Medicare where everybody or Medicaid where everybody who needs health care can have access to it, something's got to happen to the war, doesn't it? I mean, the war is it's sucking us dry.
It really is, Bob. And you know what you have just said was so eloquently stated to me in a letter from Van Junior Senior High School in Boone County, and signed by a lot of members of their senior class, in which they wrote me, and said that. Of course, they're in favor of fighting terrorism, but America went into Iraq under false pretenses. We now know Iraq had nothing to do with 9-1-1. They went on for other false pretenses. They state we are trading blood for oil. And then they go on to relate what this war is costing, besides the loss of American life, but in dollar figures, relating what that could do for America's economy. What it could do for raising the minimum wage in this country, what it could do for relieving poverty in this country and in West Virginia, what it would do for putting people back to work and repairing our infrastructure in West Virginia. These students go on to write, the money spent on the war has put a tremendous amount of pressure on the recipients of Social Security. Many older Americans have to choose between medication and food because they cannot afford both. Add to this the fact that thousands of Americans still do not have any health insurance. These students have it right. And I think that's what this is all about, is the heartland of America is not being listened to here. We in West Virginia now know, unfortunately we did when we twice voted for the incumbent, but we now know that we were led down the wrong path, that this war is being grossly mismanaged and bungled in every way, and that it's time to send a message that the status quo is not working and we need to bring our troops home.
Well, Congressman, one last thing. All of that is, I would love to see that letter find its way into the congressional record or read on the floor or something.
We're working on it.
To the extent that a lot of us liberals, a lot of us progressives, saw the war in Iraq coming and it would appear pretty accurately predicted its outcome, we also see something evil this way coming in terms of Iran. Is it conceivable that George Bush could use the Iraq war resolution as his casus belli for some sort of an attack on Iran?
Well, that was one of my disappointments in this supplemental, and I expressed it to a number of people, and it almost led me to vote against the supplemental, was when we took out the language that required congressional approval for a strike against Iran. That language, unfortunately, was not in this supplemental. It was taken out because a certain lobby in town could have sank the whole supplemental with their power. So to please that certain lobby here in town, those words were taken out. I wouldn't put anything past this president. I kind of think he's using the current British situation where their soldiers have been taken by the Iranians.
When I saw that had happened, Congressman, the first thing that came into my head was Gulf of Tonkin.
Yeah.
And it sort of screamed to me, because rather than looking for a separate reason to attack Iran, if something happened vis-a-vis the Iraq theater of the war that allowed him to do it, then I mean these are the kind of people over there in the administration that wouldn't hesitate to engage in some legalistic or legislative gymnastics to get at what they want. And you know, you're not just talking to folks in West Virginia, you're talking to thousands of liberals and progressives all over the country who are very every day I hear it, Congressman, they expect this administration to attack Iran, and we desperately want to stop it before it can happen. Is there anything that the Congress can do I hate to use a phrase like preemptive strike, but preemptively prevent this war?
At this point, Bob, I can't say there is, except, of course, again, we go back to the power of the purse. But the president can still proceed with whatever funds are already in the pipeline and or in the budget of the Pentagon and Defense Department. As commander-in-chief, I'm sure he can find the funding from somewhere. But if he wants to do that tomorrow, he has the authority and the capability to do it.
That's terrifying to me,
it
Congressman.
Is terrifying.
And the thing with Iran that bothers me most is the rhetoric that is out there. I do, as you can well imagine, I do a lot of reading. Everything that I can get my hands on issues such as this, and I don't see anything out there that suggests that Iran is anywhere near to enriching uranium to the point that it could be used in a nuclear weapon, and yet that's trumpeted about in the so-called mainstream or corporate media almost every day. If Iran gets one nuclear weapon, which I'm not in favor of, but if they get one, that means Iran has one nuclear weapon. Israel has 200. Pakistan has 20 or 30 or 40 or 50. India has 50 or 75 or 100 or 1,000. We don't know. And we're going to sit here and take this nation to war over one nuclear weapon? When, in fact, sitting in Pakistan, and I don't know if you heard the news as we were coming into the interview, thousands of people were arrested in Pakistan today protesting Pervez Musharraf. There's a lot of people there. Those Muslims are heatedly opposed to the Muslims who are in Iran. It's a Sunni versus Shia thing that I'm sure you're well aware of. Not so many in the administration, I think, are. Have we got some part of this sort of backwards?
Well, it's, you know, the specter of a nuclear Iran does scare a lot of people. And nobody wants to see it. It only proliferates the spread of nuclear weapons, as you have alluded to in your comment. And we all want to see that halted. But yet, everybody is saying, well, the other guy has them, so therefore I'm going to have them, too, to protect myself. And it becomes a matter of each country developing these weapons for what they claim are defensive-only purposes. But if everybody's got them and it only takes one mistake or one slip up or very innocent sometimes, or maybe an innocent event to cause a release of all of them, and then we're all in trouble. The whole world is in trouble. Somewhere the madness has got to stop. And we have to have all of these countries you mentioned that have nuclear weapons agree to sign a nuclear non-proliferation treaty and to live by the letter and intent of such a non-proliferation treaty. Some countries have signed it.
We've begun sending nuclear technology to India, who hasn't.
That's right. And, of course, Israel hasn't. They don't even admit they have nuclear weapons.
That's ever so true.
But in a lot of what we build up as a specter of danger in the Middle East is often because our staunch ally, Israel, wants it built up as such and wants the U.S. to take preemptive strike against Iran as they wanted us to against Iraq. And we, driven by domestic politics, as this George Bush was in his desire to get reelected, often does not want to anger that most powerful lobby in this city. And that's where we get in trouble as well.
Well, Congressman, I thank you very much for your candor. I thank you very much for your time. You know, you're always a very good friend to us, and we'll come on and answer questions straight up when we need to ask them. It's very good of you to do that, and I want to see the war over, and I don't want to see the next one start. I wish there was the will inside the Congress to, you know, spend the necessary money to bring the troops home, make sure that we can have an orderly exit from Iraq. But I also I do understand the realities on the ground that were at work for you all, and I can understand the bind that you feel like you were in. And so I can only wish you the very best when that thing. I don't know the other thing. We don't know what's going to come out of the Senate.
That's true.
But whatever comes back to you with veto stamped on it, I will. I don't often play spokesman, but I will speak for a whole bunch of liberals and a whole bunch of progressives and a whole bunch of people who really, really love our military, love our troops, and want them home and out of harm's way. When I say that, I hope the House and I hope the Senate. Will not be cowed by a veto by George Bush, and that you won't be afraid to push back a little bit.
I certainly hear you loud and clear, Bob, and there's nothing that you said with which I disagree. It is a fact of political life, however, that we do have differing views within our own Democratic caucus on this issue, and I think Speaker Pelosi deserves a great deal of credit. And there's nobody taking more heat on this vote probably than she has, because her district offices are swamped every day with protesters to the war saying that she's not taking forceful enough action. But she has done a remarkable job of bringing these diverse elements of our Democratic Party together and securing a margin necessary for passage that sends a positive signal that we are taking this country in a new direction. And to look at the reverse, you know what, if she had not built this coalition, Bob, you know what the headlines would have said across America. Bush wins in Democratic Congress.
Pelosi ineffective. Pelosi
true.
Lame duck. Yeah, and
So the alternative would have been much worse.
I tend to agree. Congressman, again, thank you very much. It's awfully hard work up there right now, and stick to your guns, and I hope we can talk again soon.
I would love to.
Thank you very kindly.
Thank you, Bob.
Bye now.
Bye.
Congressman Nick Joe Rahal, my congressman, as he pointed out, 3rd Congressional District. I had 2nd on the brain because, like I said, I was reading about Shelley Moore Capito. But my congressman, a man for whom I have voted on a number of occasions now, with perhaps some words that you would like to have heard. This is a man who wants the war over. This is a man who wants the war over as quickly as possible. But the ball now will go into the Senate, and as he said, not if George Bush vetoes it, when George Bush vetoes it. Then we begin to see what happens. And it's your job. Oh, God, he's going to give marching orders again. It's your job to let Democrats in Congress know that you have their back. There was a lot of carrying on and a lot of screaming and a lot of crying and weeping and wailing and rending of garments over that vote Friday night. Did I want that vote Friday to be bring them home, defund the war? You're damn right I did. Was there a rat's chance? Was there a snowball's chance of that happening? No. So end it. Make George Bush answer the question why he hates the troops when he vetoes that. That is why the horn exists. Because, you see, NPR won't ask why George Bush hates the troops. No matter how many times the Republicans say, oh, you know, them Democrats, they hate our troops. They're a bunch of losers. They've already done it. In this stupid little book that Tom DeLay has out now, he actually compares Democrats to Hitler and calls us liars. Whew. You know, pot, meat, kettle. But that's why the horn exists. Because we will point out the hypocrisy if Katie Couric won't. We will point out the hypocrisy if Brian Williams won't. We will point out the hypocrisy if Fox News and CBS and CNBC and MSNBC, with the exception of Keith Olbermann, won't. Organizations like Nova M, Head On Radio, what's left of Air America, will point these things out. when no one else will. If that makes us a lone voice crying in the wilderness, so be it. But the point about lone voices crying in the wilderness is that eventually people come to see what the yelling's all about. And we'll be there. And this is America's liberal voice. This is the Head On Radio Network. Be part of it. 877-443-2366. 877, the number 4, Head On. I'm Bob Kincaid.
The United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Millwrights are problem solvers. They accept any challenge and approach every project with the highest of competency and training. UBC has thousands of professionals who can be at your service giving you the best in business anytime and every time. It's their job to provide manpower. They build partnerships based on respect and trust. They provide skilled, responsible millwrights and carpenters to meet the challenge of any project because they believe and what they're doing and are so very committed to getting each and every job done right, they include a clause in your contract that eliminates work slowdown and jurisdictional disputes because they believe that, as professionals, they can discuss and solve any problem while keeping your project on target on time. We'd like to take this opportunity to thank the men and women of the United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Millwrights for building the American dream and saving the American dream. Thank you.
Obviously need to address the issue of the Saddam Hussein execution. Have seen the video that was taken on a cell phone, or have read about the circumstances surrounding the execution. It's pretty evident that the absolutely worst thing that could have happened with the carrying out of the sentence after the long trial of Saddam Hussein happened. And if we had sat down and made a list and said, all right, here's a list of 6 or 7 different things that could happen, what would be the very, very worst thing that could happen, not only for us, for the United States, but for the world and for the Iraqis themselves? And it seems to me that if not first, then definitely second would have been what indeed did happen.
The Dr. Bill O'Brien Show, Tuesday to Thursday, noon to 2 Eastern, here on the Head On Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Herbst. I play Elizabeth Weber on General Hospital. I want you to know about a wonderful nonprofit foundation called the Jesse Cause, saving the babies from Group B strep, also known as beta strep. It's named after little Jesse, who needed 3 brain surgeries, all because his mom was never given a simple test. Group beta strep is the leading infectious killer of newborns in the United States, yet most people have never even heard of it. Amazingly, 1/3 of all pregnant women have beta strep, and it's almost 90% preventable with common antibiotics. Tell your friends about beta strep, and if you're pregnant, ask your doctor to test you. Together, we can save the babies and put an end to this devastating yet preventable bacteria. For more information, call toll-free at 877-HALT-GBS. That's 877-HALT-GBS. Or log on to groupbstrep.com. That's groupbstrep.com. Jesse and I, thank you.
Okay.
Twenty-one minutes before the hour. You know, everybody always forgets that later verse in there about if you go carrying pictures of Chairman Mao, you ain't going to make it with anyone anyhow. There's some validity in that. Wait. Yeah. 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 Sorry, but, you know, I'm not a grenade chucker. And I don't want to blow anything up, burn anybody down, kill anybody. Because, see, I don't want anybody blowing me up, burning me down, or killing me. That whole do unto others as you would have them do unto you thing sort of makes sense to me. You know, I get these emails about, oh, you need to lead the revolution. How about we figure out what the revolution's going to be first? By the way, in our conversation with Congressman Rahal, he mentioned, and I didn't address it because I figured you would figure it out, he said there's a certain lobby in this town. And they would have scuttled the whole deal if we had insisted on putting language in there saying that George couldn't attack Iran. Who you reckon? Tell you what, I have absolutely nothing to give away, but I'll certainly give you one of these. A little golf clap for the first caller who tells me who that lobby is. Because I think you know who it is. I know you know who it is. Let's go to the phones. Luke joins us from Knoxville. Hey, Luke, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Bob.
How are you?
I tell you what, I just about to just bust today. I tell you what, reading some of the news coming down, life is just like, oh, thank you. Oh, so to begin with, Oberman is doing a special comment tonight, apparently on Mr. DeLay's comments.
Oh, you mean calling us Hitler?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I'd say this ought to be a good one.
Yeah, this is...
aim right between those grinning eyes.
Yeah, get the frosted mug out and, you know, pour yourself a cold something or another, because it's going to be refreshing.
Yes, indeed. Okay, the story of all stories today is a simple little story. It's this story about Henry Waxman sending the letter about the RNC server. That, to me, is the best story I've read in a long time, if you follow it out to its conclusion.
Yeah, it's a little complicated, isn't it?
Well, it's sort of like, if Carl is using an RNC server for his emails, and Carl, who has his security clearance, has sent one email having anything to do with anything of a security nature, I have a feeling there's going to be a server that's going to be seized.
Well, if you can get them to do it, because that's the thing, Luke. It keeps coming back to the Department of Justice. Who's gonna seize it?
NSA. Security.
Yeah, but whose administration is that?
That's fine. But Henry Waxman would be laying that out. Why are we not checking this to see if this has been hacked? To see if this thing has been forwarded to somebody? Is Osama and his friends list on his email?
Well...
At this point,
I would feel more comfortable sending the Capitol Hill police.
Oh, I know, but you know what I mean. That's where this is going to could get interesting. Like say, because they're going to have to answer questions on this.
Yeah.
Tony's back and he's sitting up there with his bandage on. Tony better tighten that bandage because it's going to get uncomfortable.
Back up just a minute there, Luke.
Mm-hmm.
You made the statement. They're going to have to answer questions. Monica Gooding has made it clear that she's going to answer what is your name?
No. The one on that, though, is I heard this the other night, and I agree with this. The one that's going to be fun is Kyle Sampson. They said there's two choices on this. Either Kyle Sampson, as they would say, is going to eat the bullet, or he's going to have a John Dean moment. And they're just sitting around wondering which it's
going to
be.
Or he's going to say, Congressman, upon advice of counsel, I decline to answer this question.
Well, supposedly he's coming forward to speak of his own choice. So, like I say, I'm just hoping for a John Dean moment.
Well, maybe
when
that's what
I was talking, and they're like, And the Republicans are going, oh, tell him to shut up. Dear God, just tell him to shut up.
Get him a cork. Somebody, tennis ball, duct tape, quick.
And if I say the shredding machine at the White House can't work that fast.
You know, those things have been known to overheat. Do you remember, what was it, 6-9 months ago when we were finding out that that trucks from a shredding company were going in and out of Dick Cheney's residence at the Naval Observatory?
Yeah. I tell you what. The two emails I sent you, the one we're talking about the U.S. attorneys. How did you like the one I sent you? I'd forgotten about the thing about Harold Ford's Uncle John.
Well, I was talking about that at the very beginning of the program. To me, everything that has been undertaken by this Justice Department is suspect at this point.
Well, you know, it's one of these things where if all your listeners in each of their hometowns would go to their local newspaper website and probably just put in the words U.S. attorney and just see what comes up, and then do it by date and just see what happened, like, say, October of 2006, and just see what all the U.S. attorney was doing that month. It could be interesting. I mean, that's just one I just happened to remember on that thing about John Ford. But like I say, think of it, you know, if all the other 88 or 85 U.S. attorneys out there, what were they doing in October of 2006? That could be a fun little
Well, I can, I mean, it, you know, we have to remember that this isn't just a Gonzalez thing.
Oh, no.
This goes back to Crisco John. Because I can, there was this, okay, West Virginia story. I'm sorry, but I got to do this. When George Bush took office, there was not one single Republican lawyer in this state who was competent to become the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of West Virginia, which is seated at Charleston. So he nominated, and the guy was, you know, approved by the Senate, the brother of the chairman of the state Republican Party, a guy named Warner. This guy was about as competent to be U.S. attorney as a hog is to do calculus. All right? Now, no sooner was this guy in office than he was... And you know, it smelled funny, it looked funny, it was funny at the time, Luke. No sooner than he's in office than he's got this mammoth investigation going of Democratic political hacks in Lincoln and Logan counties, which, and I know it's kind of inside baseball, it's one of those around here kind of things, but every state has one of these places. Political chicanery is, it's a sport in Lincoln and Logan counties, all right?
Understandable.
You know, if there were two people left in Logan County, West Virginia, they would be doing their dead level best to sell each other their votes. A good buddy of mine referred to one of the original members of the Logan County Five and said when he died, they had to screw him into the dirt. He was so crooked. And it's just what it is. And you'd like to clean it up, and you'd like to make it better, and someday it'll get better if we get to a point where we have the trustworthy election processes. But no sooner was this Warner cat in the U.S. attorney's office than he was, hardball on Democratic political corruption. How would you like to go and find the memo to him?
Well, imagine what the memo is for, I don't know what district it is, but the one up, I guess it'd probably be Mike DeWine's district in Ohio. Up there wondering, why aren't we looking at our Secretary of State? Be interesting to see what investigations he dropped.
Yeah, and the thing is, it's the kind of thing that I don't know nationally if we actually have the mechanism in place to find all of this out.
No.
The Democratic House of Representatives, or the Senate for that matter, would have to hire an army of lawyers, you know, 10 per district, just to go through it all. But I guarantee you, I don't often submit guarantees, Luke. I guarantee you that if you went over the files of every single U.S. attorney in the United States, and there's what, 108 of them or something?
Mm-hmm. 93.
You would find that something like this went down in every district.
Well, yeah. Well, you know, it's like I say, you know, we've just seen two or three here just between you and me. Now, like I say, imagine if you had the newspaper, if we had a real news network out there that was really into investigation, where they could contact all the different papers around the country, you know, and just say what happened, you know, during that month, and you know, start putting it up on the board, you know, and just look at it. And you know, after a while, you'd see the pattern.
Sure.
I mean, that's the thing. You'd have to have it all out there where you could see what was going on. You know, like I say, right hand, left hand, but we'll see what each of you is doing at the same time. Well, you know, it's like this thing right now. Did you see this thing today? This thing, the GSA administrator, Ms. Doan.
Oh, yeah, that one sort of lit me up.
Like I say, I have a feeling she's going to be saying, on advice of counsel, she'll be saying nothing.
Yeah, this is the administrator of the Government Services Administration.
Which is where the real money's kept.
Right, which should not be exactly a political hack.
No. I mean, this is like FEMA. This is one of those.
And she's getting marching.
What they're doing.
And she's getting marching orders.
I know. But she's wanting to give her marching orders.
Well, I've even got it backwards. She went and said, "What can I do for you, boys?"
Well, and you know something.
You know, hey, sailor.
I mentioned this to her. Had to. Oh, the one email this weekend that I sent to you, I sent it today that I really just loved. Was the thing about Jeb Bush not getting his honorary degree.
Yeah, but you do know they circumvented that, right?
Oh, crap. But you know what the thing of it was? This is Jeb, the other decider, Bush, who in his brilliant wisdom took the Florida teacher's pension. And he invested it in a little company a few years ago.
Called?
Enron.
I know.
You got to think the teachers' union was just absolutely having a field day this past weekend.
Well, see, and the you know the backgrounder for those who don't know, the administration of the University of Florida recommended one of those honorary doctorates for Jebby Bush, and the faculty senate said not in our lifetime and voted it down resoundingly,
like
and
38 to 20 something.
So then, because he had a Belgian omelet's worth of egg on his face. The president of the university hauls off and runs over to the Alumni Association. And at the Alumni Association, and you know how alumni associations are, right? I mean, these are the same people that buy Hummers, you know, because of feeling small. So they get involved in the Alumni Association so they can give $100 handshakes to football and basketball players.
Mm-hmm.
So Jebby goes to the Alumni Association and says, "Look, did you see what the faculty senate did? I tell you, Jeb, it was a dark day in University of Florida history, and I cannot countenance it. How would you feel about it? We can't make him a doctor or nothing. Well, what would you say if we made our dear ex-governor Jeb an honorary alumnus?" And the president of the university said, "That would be delightful. Excellent, excellent." So, you know, Jeb doesn't get to be a doctor of the University of Florida, but he does get to be an honorary alumnus, seeing how he couldn't be bothered. You know, he wanted to be governor of Florida, but he didn't want to go to school.
Black eye.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, I'll take it like that. Oh, the other story today, you may get to see somewhere up down the line. Well, Bush was out there talking about these flex fuel vehicles.
Oh,
every time, just always remember, every time you ever see that, anybody who's ever seen Who Killed the Electric Car, just remember. The EV1 project got killed, and one of the people who put the knife in it was George W. the Decider.
Darn straight. Oh, and by the way, while we're talking about members of the Bush family,
mm-hmm.
You did see, I presume, where
George P.
Yeah, George P. They just call him P. I guess because there's too many syllables for his uncle to call him urine.
Didn't have to go through rehab. Okay.
Right, yeah. Yeah. Well, but he's the kid who got busted doing donuts in some girl's lawn one night, tearing up their yard. He's gonna be a special intelligence officer for the United States Navy.
Oh, boy.
You can get a security clearance after a wasted, dissipated youth.
Oh, God.
No, yeah.
Turn him into a courier or something.
Oh, I don't think George P. didn't go to school in Florida either.
Nope.
University of Texas. Why do these Bushes keep going to a nice liberal university like Texas?
Well, because down there they know that probably about half the school was built by George and Daddy all funneling money through to them back when and during their state day.
But yeah, this kid. He's 30 years old now. He's going to be a special intelligence officer in the Naval Reserve.
which I say chances are means he'll probably be a courier taking the plane from Miami to Washington once every other day or something.
Yeah, here, take this pouch. Fly it to Washington, quick.
Yeah.
Yes, sir. Oh, Lord.
But I tell you what, it's one of those things, like say, you're almost to the point now, it's like, can somebody please clone Henry Waxman, because there may be too much for him to do by himself.
Well, that's what I'm beginning to worry about, Luke. How much can these people do? Here we've got another example of a Bush. I mean, there's a reason he's in the reserves, okay? I mean, if he really, really wanted to serve his country.
Say, here's the paper, George. You can sign up. We'll put you right out there in the field.
Yeah, here you go, P. You can be sweating your butt off sailing up and down the Straits of Hormuz day after tomorrow, buddy.
Hey, you know what? You get your two cousins. We'll sign Jenna and Barbara up, too. Y'all go as a group. Heck, we have no problem with that.
But, you know, Bushes don't fight. They just like the costume.
Well, if you really want something good, did you get to go to Crooks and Liars and listen to Barr's comment from Friday night?
Oh, I saw it live.
Oh, I did too. It was so good. The end of new rules. Oh, that was just so good. You could just tell he was just salivating. I just wait for David Frum was over on the other end of the panel. I just wait for him to just make a noise.
Oh, I thought his head was going to start going around doing the pea soup thing and yell, pluck me, pluck me. I mean, David Frum is slime.
Oh, I tell you what. You know, I went and looked at the after show where they do the email questions.
Right.
And the email question was him, don't you feel ashamed sometimes of some of the stuff you have to defend? Essentially, he didn't answer it.
Crickets? You hear the crickets?
crickets.
Hey, Luke, good to talk to you,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, have a good evening.
Hey, too bad about the Vols.
Well, at least the women are still going forward.
Yeah, but you know what? Bruce Pearl, they put up a heck of a fight against Ohio State.
Well, I'll tell you what, the thing of it is, they only lose one senior.
Yeah, and, you know, Laughlin's healthy, and he'll probably be back.
Only thing we got to say is, boys, at the start of next season, the word free throw is going to become your middle name.
You got nothing to do for the rest of the year except stand at that damn stripe and make free throws.
You can do this or you can run laps.
I'm shooting. Yeah. All right, we'll see you, Luke. Bye now. Okay, coming up, your phone calls if you want to. A couple of lines open. 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on. And, there's some fun stories out there to be gotten to yet. Things that I don't want to go by the radar without being noticed. Question. What's selling in Texas for more than $70 a pound? This is America's liberal voice. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
This is the Quality News Network. Senior Justice Department official Monica Goodling will not answer Senate questions regarding the firing of 8 federal prosecutors. Instead, Goodling will cite the Fifth Amendment protection against self-incrimination. Kyle Sampson, former Chief of Staff to Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, however, will appear before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Investigators now say there was no criminal negligence in the friendly fire death of former football star-turned-Army Ranger Pat Tillman. Tillman was shot to death in Afghanistan in 2004. The Defense Department released the results of their investigation today. Iran is under increased pressure to release the 15 British sailors and Marines seized Friday in Gulf waters. Tehran insists they were in Iranian waters, while Britain insists they were in Iraqi waters. Iran says it is interrogating the British forces right now. 450 refugees trying to reach Yemen from Somalia by boat were forced overboard at knife point, into stormy shark-infested waters. Those who refused were beaten and tossed into the water. Fewer than 300 survived. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon and Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice are both in the Middle East for peace talks. In Northern Ireland, an historic agreement has been reached between Protestant and Catholic political leaders. It will end 3 decades of sectarian conflict. Under the deal, the power-sharing government will start on May 8th. The suicide attack Friday against Iraq's Sunni deputy prime minister was likely an inside job carried out by at least one of his own security detail. The politician was seriously wounded, and 9 of his bodyguards were killed. In central Baghdad today, 2 people were killed by a suicide car bomb blast. 5 were wounded. The presidents of Russia and China today, 2 of Iran's closest allies, are urging Iran to fulfill the UN Security Council's demands to halt its uranium enrichment program. This weekend, the UN Security Council issued its latest sanctions against Iran for its continued defiance. And in Pakistan, more than 1,000 people have been arrested for taking part in opposition rallies against President Pervez Musharraf. Many Egyptians chose to boycott today's elections. And you're listening to the Quality News Network, Science and Business News.
Huell Hauser talks to customers of First National, South Valley, and San Benito Banks, local members of the network of preferred community banks.
We're here to talk with people about their business banking.
What are you looking for in your business bank?
Somebody that can offer me services such as car loans, equipment loans, leases, a line of credit.
And do you think because they're local, they understand your needs better than a bigger bank would?
Yes, I think they're really aware of the community and are here to help the small business people.
So it's a local bank with big bank services?
Absolutely. They're here on a regular basis to make sure if there's any other services they can provide, they're here to talk about it.
Now, it's a community bank, but it's part of a network of banks.
We searched out a bank that would have the flexibility and the understanding of our needs and a willingness to spend the time doing that.
Above and Beyond Banking from the network of preferred community banks, available locally at First National Bank of Central California, South Valley National Bank, and San Benito Bank.
A new study finds drugs are more effective than angioplasties in treating chest pain caused by clogged arteries. The landmark study reports only 1/3 of those initially treated with drugs ultimately ended up needing angioplasty or a bypass. Life magazine will be shutting down again, according to its publisher, Time, Inc. The magazine had been resurrected in late 2004 as a newspaper supplement. It's the 3rd time Life magazine has been shut down. And the top official at the Smithsonian Institution has resigned after an audit of his expenses. Auditors found Secretary Lawrence M. Small charged the Smithsonian $12,000 for service to his home swimming pool, as well as nearly $300,000 for housekeeping. His salary also more than doubled since his first year in the job back in 2000. The Intel announced it will have a much larger role in China, starting with the construction of $2.5 billion chip factory there. At the close of Wall Street today, the Dow Jones was down 12 points, the Nasdaq was down 0.5 point at 2456, and the S&P 500 was up 1 point at 1437. Light sweet crude is trading at $62.91 a barrel, and the Lundberg survey reports gas prices rose 5.6% a gallon in the past 2 weeks. There's more at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Laurel Crisson.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Buck.
Sometimes my head hurts. 5.5 minutes after the hour, this is indeed the final hour of tonight's edition, this evening's edition of Head On. I'm Bob Kincaid. Is there any office in the federal government that the Bush administration can't completely poison with corruption and graft and nastiness and so forth? Did you catch that on QNN? The secretary of the Smithsonian Institution? Now, I profess my ignorance. Do we pay him? Guy got busted for using the Smithsonian as his pool boy? Oh, cabana boy. Doubled his salary since he took over in 2000? Wow. Just kind of makes your little head hurt. On the phone right now, we have our good friend Michael Stettler, known and loved by many of us as Steady, who calls in from the Mississippi Gulf Coast area. Hey, Steady, how are you?
Hi, Bob. How are you?
I'm getting along. How about you?
I've had a really busy week out here and maybe a little relaxed schedule with the big media event in the opening days, the first day, first hour of 100 Homes in 100 Days. That's just one of the organizations that are operating out of the Pascagoula Rec Center, former high school here. There's Mississippi Home Again, and Operation TLC, and those are all .orgs. I came down to volunteer skills as an electrician, but the need was to actually go to the properties. I drove my car out here so I could do that for them. And the tape measure is the tool that I've been using most, pen and paper, getting these material requisitions or property assessments, done, and then coming back and putting them in a format that we can fax them over to the supply center.
Well, what are your initial impressions of what you're seeing there?
When I was driving across the 10 eastbound, I didn't see, and forgive me for I'm sitting in the center here. It's a basketball gym at the desk, and people come and go, so you might have a little echoes in the background. But
that's okay.
I went to visit Sarge when we were heading this way, because he is the one who was kept calling in, and you kept taking his calls. And I was up in Oregon, and it was really cold, and I'm waiting for spring, and I just figured I could be useful down here. So as I'm driving up Sarge's, I've seen trees snapped off. I saw some buildings that probably were sitting just like they were after the storm had passed over, unattended. But and did a little work for Sarge, got his lights going. But the general area, people are moving around, and the streets are flowing, but the first thing that I noticed was that the debris from people who are, improving and cleaning up the mess and getting back to normal somewhat, the trash is having it's a logistical problem to pick up the trash at all these places. So you notice it immediately when you drive through the neighborhoods going down the main streets. It might not be so evident, but you can see when you go into the neighborhoods without question that some homes have not been addressed. Many have not come back. The boards are still screwed up to their windows, and no sign of life in those. And many houses in Moss Point, I've been to Ocean Springs, Van Cleve. These areas got hit pretty hard, but I don't think I've seen the worst of it yet. I mean, I couldn't have since I'm down here, but I cried for the first 3 days a couple of times. Trent Lott's house is down here, and I went down to the front there, and the pier, it's like the major landmark here on the beach in Pascagoula, is still completely busted up. It made me cry when I saw it. I'm from the beach. I surf. That's my zone, and to see the pier just smashed, I was like, how come you didn't take care of that? That was...
Well, we got casinos to get open.
Well, yeah, they closed the Navy shipyard here with the BRAC, the administration's RAC program with base realignment, and the area suffered from that. There's a strike here with Northrop Grumman, and the members are out on the streets doing their picketing, and I've stopped by and visited a few of them. I gave them some of my flags, so now my flags and with my little card on them are part of their protest and union strike. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that is. What union?
I was visiting the Boilermakers. I went by the IBEW 733 here in Pascagoula. I talked with the assistant business manager. Gosh, I forgot his last name, but it's Lewis. And he actually showed up here. I invited him to show up at the media event, and he did. So shouts out to Organized Labor for showing up, and they didn't confirm any volunteers, but he said he would ask. He'd ask his membership, but with the strike going on.
You got to have people on the line.
Yeah, they have time, but they're on the lines, and it almost creates a tension that's normally not there in the family. So going to volunteer, maybe the significant other might say, well, you could do something around here.
Yeah, that's when the honeydew list comes out.
Right, right. So I was crying, you know, just turning corners and seeing houses that were devastated. I've gone into people's homes who are living there with children, and within 5 minutes in a couple of homes now for sure, I have had, you know, I feel the breathing. I feel what it is, and they're living in these homes. They don't have anywhere else to go. Many of the people who had to ride out the storm here didn't have transportation, and the public transportation, you know, wasn't available. And they had been here. Many of the people who I've talked to had been here before, through even in the 60s with Camille.
Sure.
And others, and said, we never had anything like this. We didn't expect the water to come. We never had water in our house before, and we had a lot of hurricanes. I've been here since the 60s, and Camille is the one that everyone references that was really bad, but nothing like this.
Well, Steady, I mean, you say you don't think you've seen the worst of it. It sounds to me like you've seen some pretty horrific stuff already.
I have. You know, it's already almost, 18 months after, so I couldn't have seen the worst of it, but, you know, our president flew over the region in an airplane. I think he landed a couple places, but...
Yeah, get me a picture and make sure there's some of that good devastation in the background.
Yeah, and I was going through the AmeriCorps' welcome handbook, and there was a quote from the governor, Haley Barbour, and I quote, "I can only imagine that this is what Hiroshima looked like 60 years ago," end quote. And
yeah, Haley Barbour, there's a kickstand on a tank.
There's a guy here. There's a guy here running against him. And this was also something. One of the first things that I noticed when I came in was a sign, many signs, in front of people's houses that said "Not for sale." And I'm thinking to myself as I look at these signs, going, you know, they must be pressing pretty hard. With people are putting "Not for sale" signs out in front of their house. And as I was in the area for a little bit longer, it's actually a political campaign for a candidate. Haley Barbour, for the governor's seat in Mississippi, and his name is, Elmer Lewis Fondren, and he's running his campaign, Not for Sale. I figured I would co-opt that for my campaign. I'm going to co-opt that for my campaign.
Darn right.
Not for Sale. Steady is Not for Sale.
Well, that's, I'm amazed by what you've done, Steady. What about, frankly, to go from where you from Oregon to Mississippi, right?
Yes, sir.
In a car?
In my Honda, Team Honda. We got about a little more than 250,000 miles on that bird, and she's still running good.
You know, don't tell Detroit that.
Well, it might be our machine tools.
Oh, my God.
I mean, Detroit, I just saw on Sunday, one of the Sunday news programs, that they're having the largest of the initial impact from the subprime mortgage rate in Detroit.
Sure.
And, you know, that might be for whatever reason the loans were made, but I know that the auto industry has been shipped overseas. GM and Ford sold out.
Well, I was having the family vehicle worked on right before I came back from Alabama, Steady, and just, you know, looking at stickers there at the Chrysler dealership, and this vehicle, you know, and they give you the percentage breakdown, sort of like the ingredient label on a soup can.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, this vehicle assembled in Mexico from, and then ... transmission, Germany. Engine, Sweden. Radio knobs, United States.
Neat. We get the plastic.
Yeah. That's neither here nor there. What matters is what you're doing. What kind of volunteer effort are you seeing down there as far as this 100 homes in 100 days are concerned?
Okay, now there's a couple of different nonprofits, and let's just start with the Red Cross, who's been down here. Then there's Mississippi Home Again, and that's MississippiHomeAgain.org, and they've provided appliances, you know, washers, dryers, a lot of these things just floated away out of people's houses. They broke out windows and floated away. Some people had 6-8 feet of water. They were up in the second story or in their attics. And I believe those came from Phoenix. That was an effort. They landed the appliances here on Valentine's Day, which was definitely a good day to mark the labor of love and the effort. There's TLC, OperationTLC.org, and that is Tammy Aggard and Amy Card, who are two ladies who rode this storm out. And Tammy Aggard, she was, I guess, a coffee shop. She owned a coffee shop, and she sold that just before Katrina at a loss, from what I read in some of the articles and write-ups. And she wound up in Moss Point, which is an inner city, if you will. It's predominantly black. It's where the trash is really piling up, and they won't come and pick it up. And she volunteered for the Red Cross and just started feeding people. And, you know, people were swimming to her when the Red Cross was handing out meals in REMs or real meals ready to eat,
yeah,
MREs. Amy Card is the other one, the other lady who is running TLC, Operation TLC, who's a freelance photographer from Peterborough, New Hampshire. And she came down here to document on film what was happening. And the two crossed paths. And in the quote in the paper said that when Amy met Tammy, that the first thing, she was the first one out of hundreds of volunteers that was just as outraged at the conditions and the lack of response, and they immediately, you know, clicked. And they said, we can do more. And they formed a nonprofit, and which became Operation TLC. And they've been doing this, I think, since September officially, but like I said, since the storm came, they were doing it for Red Cross and other volunteer organizations and seeing what was being done, what needed to be done, and felt that they could do something more. There's no end in sight to the relief effort that's going to be required to bring it back to normal. And I don't know if we can actually bring it back to where it was, you know, with the potential for more storms. And at whatever perspective you see on the cause for global warming, the temperatures are rising, and the waters in the Gulf are pretty warm. I don't know, you know.
Not much surf.
Not much surf, no.
Sorry, I don't mean to inject levity, but I know the way you think, and I know you looked out there and went, nice surf.
Not here.
Well, you know, this is the first day of the 100 homes in 100 days, right?
Yes.
Is it possible?
I believe so. They're not leveling or building completely 100 homes in 100 days. Many different people have volunteered their time to come here and assess the properties. We have the Amish, a big group of probably 50 or maybe 35 to 50 Amish that came in today. So, I mean, we've got the whole spectrum of people who have concern and skills, and just shouts out to the Amish from the work that I've seen going on around here. Their skills are far superior to anything that I've seen going on down here. So props to the Amish for coming down. Thank you.
Yeah.
And, people have been getting ripped off at the roof. You got a 1,000-square-foot house that needed roof. And I'm coming back, you know, 3 months after the roof has been done. And it's sagging. I get out of my car, and the first thing I go, whoa, look at that roof. That's a new roof. And there's just a big dump.
And this is all kind of your bag. I mean, you're conversant with a lot of this stuff, right?
Absolutely. From not only the payroll standpoint and running crews, but from actually doing the work.
People are paying a prince's ransom for a roof, and 3 months later the thing's sagging and getting ready to fall in?
That's correct, and it's like a 25 to 40% ratio of the homes that I'm actually going out to. The first thing that people really needed was roofs. So when I said I haven't seen the worst of it, that stuff was already addressed when I come up, and they've already gone through the necessary evil of the paperwork required to go through the hoops to find the funding to get somebody to come out there, then to order the material. And, you know, once I turn the paperwork in here, it actually flows. And I don't know how long it takes for the people to actually realize that this organization is here. But new people find out every single day that that TLC is in operation. We're here for you around the front of the desk. I think it's 577 days now since the storm. We're here for your needs. Here
to and, of course, JCCSC.org, Jackson County Community Services Coalition.
Oh, yeah.
Jim Yancey.
I've got him right below Tammy and Amy as well.
Okay.
He is a wonderful man and has definitely made me feel welcome. And he actually said to Mike McMillan on the VFP bus tour that we have one of your guys here, and he's just we're just really glad to have him. And Michael McMillan of VFP in Mobile, Alabama, we had a rally yesterday, told me that, and that just made my day, made my week. So thank you, Jim Yancey, many, many times over. He was below Tammy and Amy on the list of others who have,
yeah,
that I have.
Well, and you're gonna meet some angels down there.
I have,
and it's not surprising because the devils aren't hanging out there steady. The devils are in cozy little contractor offices in in Northern Virginia and paying visits to the president and making sure that they get their feet in the trough. I'm not surprised to hear that you're surrounded by angels down there. The problem is too much work, not enough angels, isn't it?
Yeah, on the massive scale, as we had probably 150 people take off to do the first seven houses, we had a little bit of a logistical challenge with tools and getting there, but it was like they could chain gang all the material out to the street. I mean, it was just that. And I have to tell you and share and give props to the college groups as well as the church groups who have come out here and given their time. The energy level is high amongst the volunteers. I have to say that. And I almost feed off of that when you see everybody kind of moving around and happy to be here. And the spirit's high. And I've been passing out my flags from everybody, like I mentioned, to the union strikers, to the trash truck guy who empties our trash here. I gave him a couple of flags, and he stuck them up in the window. And, you know, I saw him later on in the day with my flags in his windshield.
Cool. What about
now?
I'm sitting here looking in the chat room at the same time I'm talking to you, Steady. What is required for folks to get their homes worked on? I mean, are they signing any sort of second mortgages to get it done, or do they have to show a deed or what?
Not for this program. Not for TLC. TLC is funded through Salvation Army and Red Cross grants. The homes that are involved with 100 homes in 100 days, I believe the majority of them are not complete losses. The homes that are complete losses and are going to be complete rebuilds are going to be financed, but they're going to be, and this is what I got from their pamphlet that was handed out to everybody today. They're buying down the mortgage because this area that they sectioned out is a predominantly lower income tax, or income tax bracket, or income area than the rest of the county, I believe. So the stats say, and the funding for the thing is what they say, buy down. They're going to buy down to their purchase level that they can afford the monthly payment. But I haven't seen one. I haven't gone to a home that needed a complete rebuild as part of 100 homes in 100 days. There was one for TLC where I said, this is beyond my scope. You need to have a structural engineer say it's okay. We can't spend the resources of this organization hanging drywall and doing ceilings and redoing your flooring, and they say your structure is not sound, and we just wasted a bunch of time, money, and effort. So I do have my limitations out here, but for the most part, all of TLC is grant money, and I'd say 90% of the money, involved with 100 homes in 100 days is all grant money. The only people who will wind up with some type of required payment are those whose homes are going to be completely rebuilt.
Okay. what kind of needs are you? I'm asking you a bunch of questions, and I hope you don't mind me doing so, Steady.
Not at all.
What kind of needs do you still see down there as far as getting the work done?
More honest contractors. There are lots of people down here volunteering, but they need skilled labor, honest, skilled labor. People can volunteer for a day or for a week or for a month or for a year. You can stay at a place like this that charges a nominal fee for three hots and a cot, which is $6. But the skilled labor, local skilled labor, and that's why I was thrilled to see the IBEW Local 733 representing, because they represent, if you get the electricians on the job, or if you get the plumbers on the job, or you get the carpenters on the job, the word gets out that they're doing a good work, and then, you know, they tell someone else, and a couple people show up, and a couple weeks later, you got more people showing up.
And in a short amount of time, you've got crews.
Exactly, who actually can run with it. Okay, I mean, they bring their own tools. They know how to do it. They know that what they can and can't do by way of the code. There's a tremendous amount of experience represented in the local union halls in every trade, and you can't teach someone in 1 month or 1 week just this second nature, I know how to do that, or I know what we can do to go around that in a week. You know, 20 years of experience.
I've worked with on projects around my own home, trying to learn to do something that would seem as simple as hanging drywall. And, you know, I got done at the end of a week. I was like, well, we got another thing to add to the list of stuff that Bob will never make a living at.
Oh, dear. Lots of drywall to do around here, though, that's for sure.
but it's not a gimme.
It's not.
There's a right way and a wrong way. And, you know, hang a piece of sheetrock on a wall frame that's not square or not plumb. And too bad, you know.
You're see it when the paint's done, and they're like, "What happened?"
Yeah, and you're looking at it, and it's like, damn, that's kind of cool. It's got waves in it.
Yeah, maybe a little texture coat will cover that up. That's what they do now, is to cover the imperfections. They slam them out. Not saying this organization, but in general, when you're talking about the tract housing that's being done in Southern California, the quality of the work is there, but the finished product is, you can see they cover it up with texture.
Yeah.
You know, in the drywall.
Well, can you guesstimate, you said how many Amish had come down?
I think it had to be 30 at a minimum, so I'll be on the conservative side, 30 to 40.
Okay. So how many, in this particular operation that you're involved with, how many people are on it?
Right now we have students from Ohio, Missouri, and another group came in now that I didn't find out where they're from, but the facility here, I believe, can berth 150, and we're probably at maybe 50% capacity right now, 65. There was a group here, we were probably 75% midway through the week, and they left as last week finished. So we had a couple of days of empty racks, and then other people filed in. It's really a logistical improbability to pull off the birthing and the meals and the tools and the jobs and the material, and they're doing it, man. And AmeriCorps, the young people from AmeriCorps are studly, and they gave me a sticker today, and I was so proud to put that on my car, man, because these young people are our next generation, and they're learning how to build things. Like our Army Corps of Engineers, those who were fighting in World War II, many of the veterans from World War II went into the Conservation Corps, Army Corps of Engineers, and they knew how to build a city overnight. We've lost that skill as a nation. It's not here anymore, man, and we shipped what was left overseas. And these young people with the AmeriCorps and the National Civilian Conservation Corps, what they called it, a similar organization now, they're a pleasure to work with. They have spirit. It's somewhat regimented in that they all had their nice whites on this morning, black pants and white shirt, where they have a, I guess, relaxed ash-colored gray stuff that they wear. And it's really cool to sit in a parking lot that's full of government vehicles that you know are being useful. and they're not spying on us, and they're not doing things to subvert and usurp the authority that we the people are supposed to maintain. It's just great to see someone doing the real thing. Like a new crew of AmeriCorps people came in here from Missouri. They were helping clean up the ice storms. So these people are going, these young people are going all over the nation and helping out with the disaster relief and maybe some other things that are maybe not national disasters, but wherever things are needed, that's where they go. And it's just a pleasure to work with them. It's just great.
Well, it sounds like there are heroic labors ahead. And that it's going to take a lot of time and a lot of effort, Steady. But I got to say that knowing you, that with folks like you down there, there's a much greater likelihood of it being a success. How long do you plan to have your tent pitched down there?
Well, we're in a basketball gym, and you can actually see the inside of the facility if you go to www.operationtlc.org. And there's some pictures of the facility. I'm going to be, I volunteered with Jim Yancey from Oregon via email for 30 days. The clock's been running. We're into the second week, so I've got 2 weeks and some odd days. Friday's the day. I'll probably give him a Saturday and take off on a Sunday. Another couple weeks and a couple days I'm going to be down here.
Well, I hope when all is said and done, you'll give us a complete rundown on how it all went, how you feel it went vis-a-vis whether it was a success, and you know, beyond that, an idea of what it can mean to give of yourself on that level and in that way. And a last question, Steady.
Sure.
Is it your impression that these folks have everything they need, or is the need continuing and rolling and running and going and gonna continue?
I think it's probably more of the latter. There are tools, there are trucks, there are volunteers, but I think the need will be ongoing. And as you continue to do this stuff, tools break, wear out, need replacing, get lost. And,
saw blades don't last forever.
That's correct. So, as a props to all the organizations down here, people can make donations of tools and trucks and money and money and
money. And lest we forget, money.
Appliances, furniture, just no clothes. They don't handle the clothes. And I can give a phone number to call for this. I can write checks for that.
Absolutely.
The phone number here at the office is 228 area code 712-2669. And if they want to send checks, it would be Operation TLC or Mississippi Home Again or Jackson County Community Services. And the address is 2935 Pascagoula Street, Pascagoula Street in Pascagoula, spelled the same way, MS for Mississippi, and the zip code is 39567.
Well, Steady, hang in there, brother. I'm proud to know you.
I'm proud to know you, Bob, and you and Agus are doing a wonderful work. You're just as heroic. Thank you, Sarge, for giving me the opportunity and kept on calling and calling and calling. Thank you, Tammy and Amy, and Jim Yancey, last but far from least, Mr. Yancey, I thank you for the opportunity, truly, sir. And Bob, again, once again, thank you, and Agnes.
We love you, Steady.
It's a pleasure.
Well, it is indeed our pleasure. Steady, get some rest. I got a feeling your days are long, brother.
They have been. It's been a little bit relaxed the last couple of days. I had a great weekend, and I hooked up with BFP in Mobile, Alabama. I'll talk about that one on another one.
Okay, sounds great. You take care.
Thank you, Bob.
Bye now.
Do the same. Bye-bye.
Wow. You know, I met... this is like so much of the situation, given the nature of what we do here. You meet folks online, and to a large extent, in many ways, meeting folks online has a negative rep. To the extent that, you know, there's T-shirts out there that say things like, it's got a picture of a grizzled old dude on it, and it says, I'm the 14-year-old, your 14-year-old is typing too. There's some creepy stuff on the internet. But you know what? What we have found out, for the most part, is the folks that we have met have been absolutely amazing people. And, you know, I knew Steady from talking to him, emails, that kind of thing, long before I ever met him at Camp Democracy last September. And there are amazing human beings out there, and Steady is one of them. Took off to Camp Democracy, showed up there in D.C. and said, what do you need done? And it they came to me and said, you know, we don't know where you found this guy, but man, yeah. And, you know, we didn't send him. He saw a need and answered it. And, you know, I should say this this as well. It is a crying damn shame that what is going on in the way of rebuilding down there is having to be done in this fashion. This is why we at least thought we had a government. Because when disasters like this strike on a level like this, it is more than any individual can cope with. It is more than any well-intended group of individuals can cope with. This is where the expertise of tax dollars that can be had with tax dollars comes in an organization like FEMA. It is worth remembering, and you know, FEMA was born out of a dire need to teach kids, in the case of a nuclear emergency, how to crawl under a desk and kiss their butts goodbye. But it evolved. Oh my God, he said evolution. It evolved from that into something meaningful. And it was, no calls from the Clinton haters, please. It was under Bill Clinton that FEMA was raised to a cabinet-level position. It was under George Bush that it was taken away from a cabinet-level position and treated like the red-headed stepchild of the administration. No calls from the redheads either, please. Yeah, the one sitting right beside me is giving me the evil stink eye as it is. But you get what I'm going for, or what I hope you do. I wish it did not take the heroism of 40 or 50 Amish and somebody like Michael Stettler. I am grateful as I can be that they're willing to put out that kind of an effort. But I wish to God we had a competent government. I do. Because then the labors and the heroic efforts of folks like Steady and all the people down there right now could be focused and funded in a far more meaningful fashion, I suppose. We have a federal government. We have an incredibly rich country. Until a certain fellow entered the White House with a surplus and had worn it out, and we were in deficit spending inside of 6 months. But that government is supposed to be able to attend to these needs so that the well-meaning and hard work of individuals can be focused in the sort of little mop-up places where individual efforts... We're talking Red Cross and Salvation Army. The devastation of an entire geographical region is beyond the scope of the Red Cross and the Salvation Army. It is up to we the people, and I don't mean we the people sending checks, and I'm not urging you not to. I want you to, because it's not going to get done otherwise. But let this be a lesson, for the love of God, to all of us. Of what happens when you put cronyists, when you put corporatists, when you put people who put money before people into office. Yeah, they stole the elections. You know why they were able to steal the elections, these stinking Republicans? because there's of the number of people who vote in a presidential election as compared to those who are eligible to vote, it's about half. And that other half is more likely to vote with us than they are the other side. The Republican Party has mobilized all it can mobilize. It has got every last weird little fundamentalist, the biblical literalist, out of the woodwork. They got no more. They've committed the shock troops. What have we done? Who have we mobilized? What do we demand of a Democratic president in January of 2009? How do we get a Democratic president? You know, and you can have your quiet conversations about Hillary versus Obama versus John Edwards versus Dennis Kucinich. I will tell you here and now that any one of those people, Hillary included, is better than Rudy Giuliani, John McCain, Sam Brokeback, Brownback, sorry, this creep John Cox, any Democrat that runs is better than one of these goons, because you know that these goons are part of a party that is morally, ethically, and philosophically dead. Burned up, gone. You know that. Now, it is purely a question of degree as to how much better any one of those Democrats I named is. For the most part, I would say that the measurement for how much better is, by God, exponential. And no, guess what? You're not going to get a perfect candidate. But you need a candidate who understands what the function of government is, and that function is not to be the private playground and party caterer of less than 0.1% of the population of this country. And because that is how you got where, that's how we got where we are on the Gulf Coast, in the Ninth Ward, all up and down the coast. That's how we got here. We got here on the back of Grover Norquist, who wanted to drown the federal government in a bathtub, and the bathtub just happened to fill up when the levees broke. And that's when we saw his hands around the neck of his handprints around the neck of that government. And that's when we learned. You know, my conversation with Congressman Rahal, at some point, the Congress and the people of the United States have got to tick off all the myriad times that George Bush has screwed up every blessed thing that he has laid his hand to, and say that enough, enough, enough is enough. You don't get to screw up anything else, George. Sit still in the corner until your time is up, because we are not going to permit it anymore. And it is up to us to permit it or not. Now, there are a lot of people in our party who have not learned that lesson yet. Who have not learned that it's okay to look that jug-eared, beady-eyed little lout in the eye and tell him that he is a manifest, consistent, persistent, pathological screw-up. You don't know how bad I want to say what kind of an up he is, and the word is not screw. But you know it, and I know it. So we'll take a break, we'll come back, and we'll finish out the program. This is America's liberal voice. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Sweetie, I love you, but those jeans have got
to
go.
Yeah, I know. Grab me a pair next time you go to the store, would you?
No.
Huh?
I'm not going there anymore. I can't stand it.
What do you mean?
It's just awful, honey. The only smile in that building is that big yellow face. Everybody else looks miserable, and I can't find anything there that's made in our country. That bothers me.
Well, nobody makes clothes in America anymore.
Au contraire, mi amigo. There's a ton of American-made clothing at No Sweat.
Well, where's this No Sweat store? Out at the mall?
No, silly. I found them at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. There's a link there. I already ordered some great workout gear, and I also got you some new jeans. They'll be here in a couple of days. Surprise.
HeadOnRadioNetwork.com?
Uh-huh. Just click on the No Sweat banner. You're right there. Helps union workers and helps support America's other liberal network. Cool, huh?
I knew listening to the horn was a good idea.
Whose idea?
Your idea, dear. All the good ones are.
Union made? No sweat. Great prices? No sweat. Great looks? No sweat. No sweat at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. Click the banner. Do the right thing.
There's one place on the web you can go that's so topical, you can apply it liberally. WD40.com. WDYAD40.com. Claude, Wally, and Dookie are there. They're working hard every day to give you updates in news, politics, and a great sense of humor. Just stop on by and see the boys at WD40.com, a place where you can raise your voice and be heard. WD40.com, your one-stop shop for all things progressive.
As I understand the conflict right now between the president's bill and the one supported by the Democrats, John McCain and Lindsey Graham, is that John McCain and Lindsey Graham and the Democrats say that the bill, the standards we use, should be the standards that are the same as the treaty we signed, the Geneva Convention signed after World War II that every civilized nation follows. And the president is saying, that restricts me too much. That's too humane. I want to be able to do other things. I won't say what they are, but sources tell us that things like waterboarding, you know, drowning people, putting them in 50-degree weather. And the question, I think, is should we hold the United States to the same standards that England holds itself to, that Canada holds itself to, that other civilized nations hold themselves to?
Get the view from inside the Beltway with Mark Levine on the Radio Inside Scoop. Right here, 2 to 3 p.m. weekdays on the Head On Radio Network.
Hi, this is Sarah Jessica Parker. It's hard to believe that 1.5 million people in New York City are at risk of going hungry. More than half of them are children and the elderly. The Food Bank for New York City provides the food that soup kitchens, food pantries, and shelters use to feed those in need. Now more than ever, we need your help in the fight against hunger. For more information, visit the food bank at www.foodbanknyc.org.
We gotta get a webcam in here. Bouncing up and down in my chair. Got my hair pulled up in a spike. Flock of Nimrods. Alright, it's cool. Take it down, Agnes, before he starts singing, or I'll start singing too. Saw your eyes. Oh, God. One last story before we wrap it all up. And like I said, going into the top of the hour news for this hour, guess what's selling for $70 a pound, more than $70 a pound when you think about it, in some cases, in the great state of Texas? That's right, baby. Yeah, I'll take a pound of baby. No, no kidding. I wouldn't lie to you. I mean, one of my favorite books is Heck by Gary Jennings. It's just a great piece of historical fiction. And yeah, for the sexually squeamish, there's some icky parts too. But there's this part where he's walking through the desert with the Chichimeca people, whom he thought meant really rabid dog people. And at one point, you know, they're eating some sort of dried meat, and he says, what's pretty good? What is it? And they go, baby. Baby what? Baby! you know, they were kind of cannibals down there. Well, this is a little bit like that. The Republicans, a particular Republican in the great state of Texas by the name of Ken Paxton, has introduced something in the Texas legislature that goes by House Bill 224. No. That was a different bill. That created Choose Life Plates. No. This is a new bill by Texas State Senator Dan Patrick. See, I want to get to this story so badly, I'm screwing it up. Patrick's SB 1567 bills itself, oh, for heaven's sakes, as the Adoption Incentive Program. Now, this Adoption Incentive Program offers... Now, here's how it works. You got to be a girl. You got to be pregnant. But you can't be a Mexican pregnant girl or any other kind of non-American. But if you go to an abortion clinic and you think about having an abortion... And then you come out of the abortion clinic and say, I'm not going to do it. No, Monty Hall, I'm not going to do it. Give me the envelope that Carol Merrill is now bringing down the center aisle. Well, according to Texas State Senator Dan Patrick, at that point in time, after you've verified that you're an American pregnant girl, and that you're really pregnant, and that you've really, really thought about murdering your baby, then the great state of Texas will write you a check for $500. That's right, $500 for your baby, you American pregnant tramp. I'm not kidding. Damn, I wish I was kidding. I'm not kidding. But remember, Maria from across the Rio Grande, she can kill her babies till hell freezes over at abortion clinics all over Texas, and she don't get the $500. And, you know, you take your average, it's 7 pounds, seven times, yeah, it's 7 pound baby, 490, it's a little over $70 a pound. Now, this is also being billed as the Texas Baby Purchasing Act of 2007. Because, you know, being here in West Virginia, you get the weird little story. And I remember 5-10 years back, a couple in, I think, Clay County, West Virginia, was busted for offering to swap the baby for a VCR and a truck that runs, or some such crap as that. We'll sell or swap for a hide a bed and $45. Call 140-RING-2 and ask for Bill. Central, get me Bill. But you get the idea. This is what they think about. Now, if the girl wants to give the baby up for adoption, but she hasn't visited the abortion clinic, no $500 for you. I'm not kidding. Let's see. The program must include a $500 payment to each woman who is a resident of this state and a citizen of the United States who places a child for adoption rather than have an abortion. I don't know how you prove the abortion part. You know, I mean, she's up in the stirrups. No, really, I was up in the stirrups, and they said, we'll give you $500. And I said, you know, undilitate me, for God's sakes. There's a check involved. Yes, Nurse Agnes?
Wait a minute. $500 for you to carry a child to term. Okay, do they...
Yes, and it also works out to less than 7 cents an hour.
I'm not even talking about hourly wage here. Do they pay for the prenatal care? Is there genetic testing involved?
You know, I mean, it's Texas.
Yeah, but
how much do they have left in their Medicaid program?
Wait a minute. They're doing the ultrasound first, of course, to show the woman the fetus, right?
No, that's South Carolina.
Oh, I'll bet you Texas is doing it, too. But what do? Do you get all the babies in a herd and then take them to auction and start auctioning them off?
I got a lovely 7-pound, 6-ounce specimen here. White.
Ladies. Anybody
blue
out there
eyes, what hair it's got appears to be red. What am I giving for this 7-pound, 6-ounce baby? I got $500, $500, $500. Who give me $500? $500. I got $500 over here. How about $550? Can I get $550? Somebody give me $550. I got $550 in the back. $575.
He's getting into this, isn't he? Yeah.
Okay, the show's over, Agnes. No, we're done, honey. Texas. There's too many great Texans out there, and I love them dearly. Can you guys do something about Senator Dan Patrick? And wait till the real Dan Patrick hears about this. He'll have a conniption on his little sports show. Wait till Keith Olbermann tells him about it. He does a radio show with him. Jesus! That's it. What a fun show tonight. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. It was produced, of course, by my lovely, talented, and darling wife, Agnes, whom I cut short again. Damn it. Brian Reznor announces. John Fox produces. Ben Birch at WhiteRoseSociety.org is the hardest working man in political talk, in liberal political talk. And he makes the streams, the podcasts, and the archives all happen. This is 4 days in a row. I can't get through the credits. He's got a fundraiser going on. For the love of God, do the right thing if you value this programming. Peter Godbold of Godbold Computer Services in Tallahassee, Florida, is our IT professional. We have wonderful mods in the chat room. If you've never been there, go there. It's free. Enjoy the camaraderie. We have wonderful news ninjas. Susan, Gene, Betsy. And all the programs on the Horn are brought to you because there are several thousand members of the United Brotherhood of Carpenters who get up every day and they go out and they build the American Dream. And by building the American Dream and supporting this network, they're helping to save the American Dream. And always, 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 RMR, it's all for you. You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
Cheney heads to hospital for examination. Mastermind of USS Cole attack confesses. Senate okays limits on Gonzales' authority. Bush affirms support for Gonzales, but Gonzales' hold on job grows uncertain. Australian detainee writes of beatings at Guantanamo. Lawmakers threaten FBI over spy powers. Patience for Iraq war is waning, says leaders. Rice warns against Iranian missile threats. Russia gives Iran ultimatum on enrichment. London is the world capital of the 21st century, says New York. Court probes limits on student speech. Taiwan to test defenses against China in a live fire drill. GOP candidates confront immigration policies. Obama more liberal than Kucinich analysis reveals. Is popular YouTube ad big trouble for Hillary? Schwarzenegger calls Rush Limbaugh irrelevant. KSM, is he the ultimate patsy and he confesses? These are the issues ahead on the Jeff Allen Wolf Show, starting now.